Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
They don't want to abolish government. They simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking with Pennsylvania State Representative Eugene DePasquale about the budget that the Republicans rammed through. Again, thank you. Again, I want to thank our Republican friends for ramming through something that steals from seniors, that steals from children, that destroys the safety net in this state. Thank you, because I'm sure that the folks who you are harming will remember you next Election Day. And your leadership in this state will be short-lived in the House, at least. Also, we're going to talk with Representative DePasquale about House Bill 916, which went down in defeat. Even the Republicans realized that the destruction of unemployment compensation is a bad idea for the state. And also, we'll talk about House Bill 1580, which is the solar bill to help create some jobs and keep that industry moving in the right direction. Smart policy, sound investment, something we need. We'll also talk to our good friend Erwin Aronson, attorney in the area, about the budget and the unemployment compensation situation and some other things that will pop up. In the second hour, we'll talk with Reed Mackey, coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition at the National Consumers League, about the five most dangerous jobs for young workers. They put out their report for 2011, and you know, you look at all the things that are going around in this country, and you've got, you know, states that are trying to upend child labor laws, basically going back and repeating, taking us back to the good old days of the 1880s, 1890s, you know, where the breaker boys were losing fingers and toes, arms and legs, you know, picking coal out off the beltways or being killed in the mines, you know, taking us back to the good old days, thinning the herd, I guess, if you will. Also in the second hour, Linda Stout, activist, organizer, and author of the book Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future, an outstanding book. We're going to get into that because, you know, when we went to Wisconsin, one of the things that I said is we've got to learn how to bring that kind of thing back home. We've got to learn what they did right, see where they, you know, made a mistake or two, and tweak it to make it ours and have that grassroots kind of uprising that I think is going to happen. Today, you know, we saw, you know, about 30 disabled citizens in their wheelchairs. Look, I mean, these people, about 30 folks came out. And I'm talking a major, major challenge for these people to get here to protest the massive budget cuts that Corbett and the Republicans are trying to ram through, you know, basically stealing their lifeline. And we've got a great video over at our site at therickssmithshow.com of one of the women speaking about the protest. And I think the line that she said, you know, if they're gonna kill us, we're gonna die in public. If the cuts that they're making are gonna kill us, we want people to see it. And good for her and good for them for standing up and taking a firm stance. Anyway, today was dentist day for me. Me and my big mouth partook in our biannual trek to the dentist to be scraped and poked and prodded. Something about having a metal object in my mouth that I just have a real problem with somebody poking me with a sharp object. But fortunately, all went well, relatively painless process. And even more fortunately is the fact that my dentist, whom I kind of suspect of being a T-Twizzler, I see him being that tea party type, you know, the quiet one who, you know, plotting behind the scenes. I'll give him credit. He is the consummate professional. He didn't take advantage of me in this situation and torture me in the chair, which I'm sure sometimes he would like. I'm sure that has crossed his mind a number of times. But, you know, here again, I do wonder sometimes if I'm missing a brain cell or two. That here I am, you know, on the chair with my mouth open and somebody with a metal object in that arguing with that person with the metal object. I don't know. But today, again, you know, the argument was Obama. The argument was the health care bill. The argument was Medicare. It was all these things. And, you know, without getting into the he said, she said, blow by blow of the conversation, I was left with one undeniable thing. And that was that we have not fought in this country for our safety net. You know, the little fact of the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, they fought for it. They lived through the Great Depression. They understood what a strong safety net meant. In the 60s and 70s, they defended it, even expanded it a little bit. But since the 80s, we have been right dead smack in the middle of these attacks. And we've been compromising and compromising and compromising. And inch by inch, they keep moving us. They keep moving us to the extreme right, keep moving us to the extreme right. You look at the unemployment compensation bill that Scott Perry put out, 916, way out on the extreme. And even he knew it was way out on the extreme. And the Republicans knew it was way out on the extreme. And that was what they wanted, so that everybody else would move just a little bit further in that direction. And they got what they wanted. When the Gordner bill passed, they got what they wanted. And, you know, I go back and I think about, had we not had those programs, had we not had unemployment, had we not had food stamps, had we not had welfare, had we not had all the things that elasticity of a safety net under us when September of 2008 happened, when the Bush collapse happened in 08, had we not had that, we would right now be in the heart of the second Republican Great Depression. The second in less than 100 years. And, you know, had it not been for the unemployment, had it not been for food stamps, Medicare, Medicaid, all of those other things, all those other programs that helped millions of American workers and their families just to make it through, to exist, to sustain through the storm, I do believe we would have spiraled into the depths of destruction and despair. We would have had massive pain and suffering, and, you know, maybe that would have been a good thing. Maybe we could have, out of the flames, arisen stronger. But you look at what the work the Republicans are doing right now to weaken the safety net even further. Because remember, they didn't want any of that stuff. They would like nothing more than to repeal the entire 20th century. But they're doing it under the guise of, well, we're going to strengthen it. We're going to strengthen Social Security by destroying it. We're going to strengthen Medicare by destroying it. We're going to strengthen unemployment by basically robbing from you. I mean, it's much like a doctor telling a patient who's got acne that we can cure your problem. We'll just cut your head off. That seems to be the Republican way of doing things. And I look at those folks who wheeled into the Capitol, and two by two they went up the elevator. Because there are no ramps in the Capitol. Everything's got to be done by elevator. And these people, they sat their ground. And there was about 30 of them there. With 25 police and security people hawking over them. Here are these people in their chairs. And you go to the RickSmithShow.com and you can look at our Flickr pictures. I mean, it is absolutely, it's scary. it is absolutely scary to see that Jay Gould was right. We could easily pay half the country to kill the other half. And at no point did I feel that those cops were, and you know, look, it's a tough job. I'm with them when, you know, when they, in their struggle. But at the end of the day, when that chief of security, Corbett's right-hand man, the chief, the head guy said, get him, there was not a doubt in my mind that those cops would have gotten them. And that scares me. And these people, they came just to have their voice heard. Say, look, these massive cuts, it's going to kill us. And Corbett would not even meet with them. Their only demand was listen to us, see us, listen to your constituents, see the pain, see the suffering, see the situation that we're in. And he wouldn't even take a second, not one second, to see his constituents and to see the pain and the suffering and the despair in these people's eyes. But what did you expect? And they sat there for hours waiting, and not even a word. All they sent were the armed guards. That should infuriate every single citizen. It should infuriate every person in this state. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Eugene DePasquale, state representative down near the York area, going to be talking about this and some other things. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you've got a question for the representative, we're right back after this. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW is defending public education in Michigan. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 10,000 people turned out in Lansing, Michigan on Saturday to protest Governor Rick Snyder's proposals to make drastic cuts to the state's education system. United Auto Workers President Bob King made an appearance to express the support of auto workers for teachers and students.
We are not spending too much on education in America. We're not spending too much on services to people. The truth is we should be demanding more. We are not spending enough on education in America.
King said that what he was seeing in Lansing was the start of a new social movement. And he called on those in attendance to pledge to keep fighting. That sentiment was echoed by many of the speakers throughout the day, including Fruitport, Michigan School Board Trustee Ben Gillette.
We cannot allow cuts in any one of these departments. We cannot allow them to put our children at risk with privatization. We must fight back against these cuts. And I'm not going to take it anymore, and I hope you're not going to take it either.
When these corporations get the one, have their merry way, there won't be a job left in the whole of the USA.
J.P. Wright's Music for Modern Railroaders speaks straight from the heart of railroad workers, drawing on the traditions of union music to tell modern working class stories. The secretary-treasurer of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, Division 78, rides the rails between Louisville and Nashville. JP's recorded music began with a joke, a variation on the old John Henry song.
We had this new technology where it was going to be replacing jobs, replacing an engineer with this little box. So I made a joke song about how the conventional engineer beat the remote control locomotive down, and people really liked it. Some of these themes are still around, but nobody's really writing any new music about it. And so that's really what I was trying to do, is make it more ours instead of a story from the past. The unions are so incredibly important to not just wages and safety and all the things that you would normally associate with the unions. It's the brotherhood and the family.
For more of J.P. Wright's music, go to railroadmusic.org.
We would sit down for supper. Well, my daddy, he would pray. Thank God and the union for our bread and butter today.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit Labor Radio.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. You know, Japan is considering a plan right now that would make it mandatory for all new buildings and all new houses built in Japan that they would be fitted with solar panels by 2030. To me, that is smart policy. It's looking down the road. It's looking to the future. Boy, it should be nice if we had some forward-thinking leaders in this country. And I think my next guest is one of those forward-leading guys, Representative Eugene DePasquale. Eugene, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure. Love being on.
You know, I look at this House Bill 1580, looking at the SRECs for the solar industry, and I think this is one of those things that we could use.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I want to commend Representative Ross, who's a Republican from Chester County. He has been and has been and continues to be leader in alternative energy, because he gets, and he's a, you know, on economic issues, tends to be a conservative, but he knows this is not only good for the environment, but it's good for the economy.
It creates jobs, and that, but, you know, here's the thing. It really goes against the right-wing mantra that government policy, government involvement can't create jobs. I look at this solar industry. The fact that you had smart policy has created an industry that has created thousands of jobs and has saved us a bunch of oil from foreign countries.
The idea that the government has no role in job creation, it's an ideological position. It's not a fact-based position. When you look at road construction, when you look at energy policy, the government has a huge role in that. And people that say, well, you know, look, the government had no role in the coal industry. They didn't get any government subsidies, or go on the way down the line, oil, et cetera. I mean, that's just a fallacy. Anything that we've done for solar and wind in the last several years is at best playing catch-up to decades-long policy that actually worked against alternative energy.
Yeah, I mean, you look all around the globe and you see countries like Germany, who gets less sun than most of the United States. They're one of the leading countries in the world. China investing hundreds of billions of dollars as we speak. All across the globe, they're getting it.
You mentioned the Chinese issue, and that should be, for anyone that says they care about national security, if you are a national security hawk, what China is doing, alternative energy, should be a huge wake-up call, because even if you follow the position that the government has no role in this from an economic standpoint or an environmental standpoint, and you and I would disagree with that, but even if you come from that point of view, clearly the government has a role in national defense, and I think that energy policy is part of should be part of our national security policy as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, you cannot possibly run a war with no energy. If you've got
not
no fuel,
run a war. But let's be really blunt about it. I think we've got into a few conflicts at least because of it as well.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I look at this, and the reason I brought up the thing in Japan is they're looking down the road and they're saying, you know, when we build new buildings, we're going to make them energy independent. They're going to have solar panels. Why can't we in this state say, you know what, for the future building, you know, 2030 down the road, by then, it should be cheaper. We should make homes energy independent, or at least get half of their energy from renewable sources.
First of all, I do think we made some strides on that in the Rendell administration. But now, of course, we're heading in the other direction. Now, look, the short answer to why, it's special interest politics and fundraising. I mean, there are, you know, the majority party right now, the interests that are not in favor of those, you know, really help put them in office. And so I think, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think that's why.
Yeah. Let's talk about House Bill 916. You know, I had Representative Perry on the program a couple of nights ago, and even he said that the bill was a corporate bill. It was the employer bill. It was maybe a little more extreme. Congratulations on getting that shot down, but it took the help of an awful lot of Republicans who saw that it was a bad piece of legislation. In looking at unemployment compensation, which I do believe saved us from a depression in this country, make no doubt about it, how do we fix the system so that it works for people when they need it, like it did, and also pay for it?
Uh, be, the way to save it, well, first of all, that bill, I have no issue with someone starting out with a bill, and Scott's a friend of mine, and we're friends, and we have strong disagreements, but we're friends. I have no problem with someone, you know, starting out a bill that may be more extreme than you would want it to pass, whether it be from the left or right, to give them room to negotiate. The problem was there was no negotiation. And I think, you know, the moderate Republicans saw that and knew that that bill was way too extreme for Pennsylvania, let alone every Democrat. How do you fix it? It's by actually following the words that so many people are saying right now. If you say it's shared sacrifice, that means it's shared sacrifice, which means, you know, employers, employees, and have to share in the responsibility. It just can't be kicking down the unemployed, the people that have already lost their jobs. The answer to the problem is not just merely, punishing them even further as if they wanted to lose their job. Because as most of your listeners know, to collect unemployment, you had to actually lose your job.
Right.
It is not a welfare program. So that means to shore up the system, we're going to have shared sacrifice with everybody, which means employers and employees are going to have to help contribute to the trust fund so we can pay back what we owe the federal government. But your broader point is, without that program, when that economy tanked and we were closing in nationally, on almost 11% unemployment, Pennsylvania, it was, a little bit over 9, what would have happened to our economy without that unemployment compensation? I mean, literally, that meant it would have meant all those people that, without that, they would have been able to feed their kids, pay their mortgage, what have you, and it would have made the recession that we had, which is obviously very, very difficult, it would have made it look like child's play if there wouldn't have been unemployment compensation. It would have been an absolute disaster like we had in the 1930s.
Yep. You know, when I look at this, and again, I go back to when the last bill, the unemployment bill was passed, I believe it was 84, where they said half of the median wage is your tax base. So they set it at 8,000. I guess the median wage back then was 16,000. They set it at 8,000. Had we kept that formula and just indexed that wage to keep up with half of the wage, I don't think we would have had this problem. And don't take this the wrong way, but I blame the folks in your building who didn't have the foresight to say, you know what, we need to make sure that this system works down the road, not just a fix for today, but also into the future.
Your criticism is right on, and I mean, and all of us need to share in that responsibility. I mean, it is pretty cheap shot politics to blame it all on the current majority. We may not have liked their measure of trying to fix it, but the reality was that, look, we had Democrats, we had the majority in the state house for 4 years, Democratic governor for 8 years. Granted, the Republicans had the Senate, but we could have and we did not. I mean, and so that we need to share in that responsibility as well for not having trying to fix it before this problem got created. And the $8,000. I mean, look, when you haven't changed it since the early '80s, clearly that is a number that is just not reasonable. If we're again, that's where I talk about the shared sacrifice. We're going to have several adjustments. Again, employers and employees are going to all have to share in the responsibility to shore the system up for the future so we don't end up having to owe the federal government $4 billion again. Look, inevitably there'll be another recession at some point down the line.
Right. Here's my hope, though. I hope that whatever happens out of this, it's not taken off the backs of those who can least afford it, the people who have no voice and the people who are struggling to get by right now. And I know you'll stand up for those folks.
Well, not only do I think we should do that from a moral standpoint, but it's also an economic thing. Economic rationale. If you own a grocery store and your region, gets the 10% unemployment and there's, no unemployment compensation, there's going to be a lot less people buying groceries.
And a lot more people stealing them.
That's exactly right.
And that means higher prison costs, which, brings me into the budget. I look at this budget, we're cutting education, cutting social services, increasing prison budget. That kind of tells me something.
Rick, $35,000 per year per inmate, $12,000 on average per kid in our public education system. It makes no sense to cut education and increase prison costs, especially when you factor in that our crime rate, I know some areas of the state have problems. I'm not trying to deny that because obviously, especially in some areas of Pennsylvania, there are still issues with crime. But overall, Pennsylvania, our crime rate is down, but yet we continue to send even Texas, which is known as a very right-wing state regarding corrections, they are starting to shrink their prison population for two reasons. Number one is they can't afford it anymore.
Right.
Number two, they realize that there's a better approach to it. If you spend more money on the front end, on education. In the long run, you're going to, not only are you going to have a better educated society with more economic opportunity, and it's going to be better for business, but you're also going to save money on corrections. The policies right now that Governor Corbett are pursuing will not only shortchange our kids, it will hurt business in the long run in Pennsylvania because we're going to have less qualified job seekers, but it also will cost state taxpayers more money as well because we're going to have higher prison costs.
And beyond that, and I look at this, and this failure to invest in the future, a very short-sighted, very really tip-of-the-nose kind of stuff where you go, what about 5 years down the road? What about the kids then? I'm really worried about the direction of this state, Representative, because at the end of this, if we lose this generation of kids, we're in big trouble.
If you came up with a game plan and said, hey, you know, I'm Ohio, I want to compete with Pennsylvania or West Virginia or New York, what could I do to make sure I have a competitive advantage in 5 years? You would say, oh, here's what we're going to do. We're going to jam a budget situation where they're going to be putting more money in prisons, which obviously won't help their economy, and we're going to have give them a less educated workforce. I mean, that would be your strategy. Well, here we are. We're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this, and I don't understand it, I guess. You know, you talk about making Pennsylvania...
It's ideological. I mean, that's the problem. You know, there used to be a time you had Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, but people would let facts get in the way. You've got a pretty significant group of people right now serving, and this both D.C. and in state house across the country, not just Pennsylvania, that it's not about facts, it's about ideology. And it's about, you know, there's a group of people that just literally believe that, you know, all public education is bad, the whole public sector is bad, and the only thing the government should be doing is prisons and military. And there's a pretty sizable chunk now that have that philosophy, and that's how you get these budget priorities.
So you see this whole fight, the end being privatizing the commons, handing over everything that we the people control in this state over to for-profit interests.
I don't think that will happen, but I'm a significant of elected officials that would want that to happen.
Because I look at education.
But as you saw yesterday in New York in a very Republican congressional district, you know, when the Republican candidate ran on privatizing Medicare, even, you know, a conservative Republican district, rebelled against that. So I think the people, when you actually draw the distinction and call it for what it is, I don't think the people want it.
Are you seeing that kind of blowback here? Because, you know, I remember the Trib Review in Pittsburgh wrote that that whole conservative wave had missed Pennsylvania. They had this extensive article on how all the things of Wisconsin and Ohio and Maine that had all just missed Pennsylvania. Yet you go through and you look at the fact is all of the same insane bills that are in those states are right here in Pennsylvania. The No Rights at Work agenda that Metcalf's pushing, all of this stuff right down the line. It's in our house.
Here's the difference, and I don't know how people will take this, but here's the difference. In these other states, you take Walker and Kasich, Ohio, Kasich, Walker, Wisconsin. I just think they are, and I don't say this in any agreement with their position, but they're much more media savvy. I mean, they were charging at the wall
right
head on. So there was much more of a quicker blowback. Because Governor Corbett, you know, really doesn't do a lot of media stuff, I'm not sure the public is really aware that a lot of this, other than the education piece, is going on because, you know, Walker, I mean, for what it's worth, at least give him credit for this. I mean, he went out and tried to make, you know, politically, you know, fight the issue head on. So the public rebelled against it, but they were at least recognizing a fight was going on. You know, I mean, has Governor Corbett had a full press conference yet?
But here's the thing. I think he's brilliant for that. If nobody's going to ask him any questions, he doesn't have to answer anything.
Republican colleague, you know, joked around, even in the Republican caucus now, they call him Governor Groundhog, which is, you know, every 2 weeks he pops his head out, gives bad news, and then goes away for a couple weeks.
Yeah. And again, those folks today who were in the Capitol protesting those 30 citizens in their wheelchairs being watched over by 25 policemen, he wouldn't take a second for them. Representative DePasquale, I know you got to go. I appreciate your time. Always great having you on the program. I'll love to talk to you again sometime soon.
Hey, thanks. I look forward to it, Rick. Have a great night.
You too. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this. We've got to the kingdom of man. All together for the world.
come to talk.
Billionaires are different from you and me, for obvious reasons, including the fact that they buy much pricier baubles than we do. A sleek car costing $100,000? Why, that's just an impulse purchase. A few million bucks for a Matisse original? Go ahead, it'll liven up the hallway. How about throwing a fat wad of cash at a university to get an academic chair named for you? Sure, it's all part of living in billionaire land. Then there are megalomaniacal mega-billionaires like the Koch brothers. Using money from their industrial conglomerate, their foundation, and their personal fortunes, these two far-out laissez-faire extremists are literally buying public policy. Their purchases of everything from politicians to the Tea Party help them push the privatization of all things public and the elimination of pesky regulations and taxes that crimp their style. To advance their plutocratic cause, Brother Charles has gone on a shopping spree for an invaluable bauble that most of us didn't even know was for sale. Academic freedom. And it's surprisingly cheap. For only $1.5 million, Koch bought a big chunk of the economics department of Florida State University. His donation gives him control of a new academic program at this public institution to indoctrinate students in his self-serving political theories. The billionaire gets to screen all applicants, veto any he deems insufficiently ideological, and sign off on all hires. Also, the department head must submit yearly reports to Koch about the faculty's speeches, publications, and classes, and he evaluates the faculty based on objectives that he sets. This is Jim Hightower saying, Charles has made similar purchases of academic freedom at two other state universities, Clemson and West Virginia. Now just imagine the screams of outrage that you and I would be hearing from the Kochs if a labor union was doing this.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Today, the governor of Wisconsin, he signed their Act 22. Again, you know, another one of these voter restriction bills. They want to make sure that you poor people and you old people and you minorities, that you don't vote. And that's basically what this is about. This is about taking people's rights away, which is why, again, we've got a bill floating through our Congress, our legislature over here. Even though the Scaife paper said, you know, all that insanity just floated right by us. Just missed this completely. Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit more about the budget and the unemployment thing and some other things, our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Erwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. How you doing, Rick?
I'm good. You know, that destructive, toxic, horrible 916 unemployment bill got shot down. There are some rational Republicans after all.
Well, it's a skirmish. The war is yet to come. 916 had something very peculiar. You know, I've been at this in and around Pennsylvania's legislature for the better part of four decades, and I can't recall another time when an actual recorded vote, roll call vote on a bill on second consideration. Every bill under Pennsylvania's Constitution, every bill has to be considered three times before it can be finally passed. This is the first time I can recall that a bill on second consideration went to a roll call vote, and the roll call vote was breathtakingly against your guest from earlier this week, Representative Perry's legislation, because of its draconian impact, not merely on the unemployed, but on every community in Pennsylvania, on every small business in Pennsylvania.
Well, I mean, for me, you look at the bill, and I think it was. I think it was that extreme goalpost to get everybody to shift over just a little bit further. It was never going to pass. It was never supposed to pass. It was the extreme to make what was coming look less toxic.
Well, when I listened to Representative Perry on your show a couple nights ago, he said that he wanted to put in some more moderate measures and amend his own bill to be more moderate. I thought that was breathtaking recognition and breathtaking statement from the chief sponsor of the poisonous legislation that Bear.
Well, the co-author. He co-authored it with the chamber and the NFIB.
Well, I know that the chamber and the NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business in Pennsylvania, believe that they are members of the General Assembly as well. But I checked, and I can certify to you tonight as an officer of the court that only Representative Perry among those authors is entitled to vote on the floor of the House of Representatives.
Well, at the end of it, his co-sponsor memo did say it was written with direct input from those folks. So that's where I got it from.
Well, I think you got it right. I mean, they have become apparently super legislators. I remember reading in my ninth grade civics class and learning from a really wonderful teacher all about representative democracy that we have. And apparently we get to participate in the election of some of those representatives, and some are just designated by the chamber and the officials of the NFIB and maybe the Manufacturers Association, a few banks, insurance companies, utilities to boot.
Yeah, well,
and maybe an oil company here or there, too, and a gas drilling company.
And a couple of gas industries, sure, why not them, too? But here's the bigger question. I mean, you know, this is now shot down. There's a couple other bills that are, the Gordner bill, I guess, is going to be the one that they're pushing through. Is that the answer? I mean, or is there some better way of doing this? Because at the end of the day, the last thing I want to see is the destruction of the unemployment insurance benefit, because after all, it did save this country from depression.
Well, I think that it's important to focus on what you've just said. In 1935, when unemployment compensation first became law in the United States, it became law as part of the broader-based Social Security Act, upon which we all try to rely, even though people in Washington are attempting to do their best to dismantle Social Security as well. And the reality is that that kind of law, those legislative proposals, that force of public policy is not simply or even primarily to help the unemployed or the aged or the disabled or the infirm. It's to help recognize that those people spend money in their local communities, in their local grocery stores, in their local pharmacies. They pay rent with that money. They pay their doctor bill copays with that money. They do all of these things, and they keep that money in the economy. One of the most breathtaking things that I heard when I listened to Representative Perry's articulations of the benefits of his bill is he made this utterance that it was going to put $500 or $600 million back in Pennsylvania's economy, and that is as far from the truth as far can be. It would take out every penny of that money from Pennsylvania's economy because everybody who's on unemployment compensation benefit eligibility right now is spending virtually 100 cents of every dollar on their subsistence and putting it in Pennsylvania's economy. When we take that out of Pennsylvania's economy and we put it back in the hands of somebody else, we know all those somebody else's in this jobless recovery are keeping the cash and not putting people to work. So that's a sham, but that's a scam. But I'm not sure what the best way to do this is. In all candor, your question really can be answered honestly by people of goodwill in a couple of different ways. I mean, one has to do with what is the visionary right thing to do, and another has to do with what we can accomplish in this political environment.
And in this environment,
making legislation, as we've discussed in the past, is a lot like making sausage. You have a whole bunch of easily identified parts, and when you put them in the machine and grind them all up, we can't tell what was the tenderloin from what was the shank from what was, gristle.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple of minutes here to talk about the budget. I mean, they rammed this through today. They rammed it through. About 30 disabled citizens of the state who took their wheelchairs into Tom Corbett's office. They were watched over securely by 25 police officers and security people.
Well, we know how dangerous those folks in wheelchairs can be to a sitting governor who's recuperating from back surgery.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of it, these are people who, as the woman said to us, you know, if I'm going to die, I'm going to do it in public. These people are killing me. This budget, dangerous stuff.
Oh, there's no question but that it's dangerous stuff. if you are young, if you are poor, if you are infirmed, if you depend upon public education access in order to get your full measure of access to our democracy, this budget is death-defying.
What are we looking? What else are we looking forward to this week?
Well, tomorrow, the boards of the state educational facilities financing agencies are meeting, and I understand, I've heard through the grapevine, there's going to be a proposal on the agenda for both of those boards for the politicians who populate those boards to vote to eliminate the prevailing wage act protections from projects that they caused to be financed. I always thought, until today, that when the legislature passes a law that applies to something, that it applies to it. Apparently, these folks believe that the law doesn't apply to them, and so they're going to force a vote on that. And Auditor General Wagner and State Treasurer Rob McCord and Representative Tony DeLuca and State Senator Andy Dinnerman, who all sit on those boards, are four square against this purported vote to eliminate prevailing wage protections on these publicly sanctioned projects. But who knows where that's going to come out? The other five members, including Republican leaders in the General Assembly, including Representative the Governor, appear to be hell-bent for leather on passing what is in effect a super legislature action, where they override the law of the land, override what has been in place since 1961 with respect to publicly funded construction projects, to assure that we don't use taxpayer dollars to finance a race to the bottom and reward contractors who would bring in either undocumented or workers from other states who pay no taxes here to steal our jobs.
So let me ask you this. You know, there's a lot of talk about this across the country, this whole prevailing wage thing, where, and maybe I'm not getting the whole right wing's take on this. Basically, they're running on a platform that we're going to steal wages from people, and they expect people to be okay with that?
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, what we do know, the only empiric evidence about the applicability of prevailing wage law was done, amazingly enough, by the Keystone Research Center a number of years ago when the Ridge administration in those days purported to create their own method of calculating what prevailing wages were, and when they dramatically diminished the required wages to be paid to carpenters, electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters, welders, sheet metal workers, painters, paper hangers, tile setters, bricklayers, roofers, etc., you name it, the actual cost for public construction of public school buildings went up per square foot. It didn't go down. So that meant that the taxpayers were paying the same or more, but the people who were doing the work were getting less.
So let me ask you this. Given that reality, I'm sure the Republican lawmakers understand that. Is there anything in their quest to destroy prevailing wage that says that we, the taxpayer, that guarantees me as a taxpayer that stealing wages from those workers is going to benefit the taxpayer?
To the contrary, if I read the budget that the House passed just today closely, one of the things that happens is that the funding for the investigative and prosecutorial work under the Prevailing Wage Act budget for the Department of Labor and Industry gets cut, gets diminished. So there'll be fewer inspectors and fewer opportunities to protect the public fisc in this regard.
So I guess I would have it no other way.
Well, you know, what do you expect? We have apparently right now among the best governments money can buy.
And then, well, but what do we do? Where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? Let's see. It hasn't been since the last time I was on your show when I suggested that people need to pick up their phones and sit in front of their computers and keystroke out a note to their state representatives and their state senators and call into their state senators and state representatives' local offices and make it clear that we're the taxpayers and we're mad as hell and can't take it anymore.
Or we do like the citizens in their wheelchairs were talking about doing today and staying. And you know what? I for a bit of time, I feared that those 30 people were in danger because I do believe those 25 policemen and their security overlords I do believe they were going to throw him out.
Well, I have every bit of faith and confidence in the Pennsylvania State Police. They're good members of the Fraternal Order of Police. They're good union members. And when push comes to shove, I understand that no matter how much their overseers try to force them into attacking their fellow citizens, they're not going to do that any more than the police officers assigned to the Capitol, Wisconsin, did that.
I sure hope you're right, Erwin.
They're good folks. I know them. I've worked closely with them. I admire them a great deal. They protect me, and they protect you, and they protect our kids and our parents. And I know that they have outstanding and excellent judgment. So despite the saber-rattling that their handlers forced them to engage in today, yep, I'm really confident that in the end, those good folks who were occupying the people's house were not in any danger from the state police. They may have been in danger from their elected representative.
I'll go with you on that. Erwin, always great talking with you. I appreciate your time.
Be good, be safe, and keep fighting the good fight.
No, we are trying. Thanks so much, Erwin.
Thank you.
Take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life to get in on our really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, there is crazy. I was just looking at a picture of Michelle Bachmann. Someone had sent me a link to one of her website, one of the parody websites, and you know, there's that one picture of her that just really, you can see the insanity raging in her eyes. Really a very interesting photo. One of those that makes me go, yeah, that's why I love her. That's why I, you know, wouldn't mind seeing her running for president. Anyway, responding to the chants of Medicare, 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 Kathy Huckle, I guess the woman, and I'm going to have to figure out how to say her name. She's the winner in the upstate New York 26th Congressional District special election last night. She responded, did we not have the right issues on our side? We cannot balance our budget on the backs of our seniors. And I would argue that not only can we not balance the budget on the backs of our seniors, we shouldn't be doing it on the backs of our children. We shouldn't be doing it on the backs of the disabled, the sick, the poor. We should be doing it in a way that there was true shared sacrifice. But she goes on to say, how about ending big handouts for big oil? How about making millionaires and billionaires pay their fair share? She said, we do all of that and not decimate Medicare, which is what the Republicans wanted to do. And if you look at the reality, government is about who gets what. They're the decider. You know, it wasn't George Bush. You know, Bush loved to say, I'm the decider. Well, government as a whole is the decider, period. And if you look at the investor class, they've been getting and getting and getting. The wealthy have been taking and taking and taking. And now they don't want to help clean up. The people who have been giving, giving, and giving, they're the ones who are saying, well, they've been giving all along. They've been getting less wages. They've been paying higher regressive taxes, more property tax, more sales tax, more gas tax, more of all the things that I agree with the Tea Party people on. Absolutely agreed. I am taxed enough already. Yet, we don't want to talk about having a progressive tax that turns this whole thing around and starts asking those who have been doing very well the last 30 years, you know what, it's your turn now. We've been paying our share. It's time for you to sacrifice a little bit. Anyway, does anybody remember Mitt Romney's op-ed back a couple of years ago titled, Let Detroit Go Bankrupt? Remember that? Remember Mitzi calling the auto rescue tragic? Remember all the Republicans on message, like our? Got to give them credit, all on message, all walking the straight line, reiterating the same let them fail lines. John Boehner, does anybody really believe that politicians and bureaucrats in Washington can successfully steer a multinational corporation to economic viability? You had Richard Shelby, senator from Alabama, Republican, who said it's basically going to be government-owned, government-run company. It's a road towards socialism. Michael Steele, the chairman of the RNC at the time, saying no matter how much the president spins GM's bankruptcy is good for the economy. The bankruptcy would be good for the economy. Republican Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina, now the government has forced taxpayer buy these failing companies without any plausible plan for profitability. Does anyone think the same government that plans to double the national debt in 5 years will turn GM around at the same time? The other, you know, Trent Franks, Arizona Republican, when government gets involved in a company, the disaster that follows is predictable. Lamar Smith, Republican from Texas, the auto company rescues have been the leading edge of the Obama administration's war on capitalism. And on, all of these doomsdayers, the road to socialism, war on capitalism. Well, you know what? It actually worked. GM's going to hire about 2,500 people here real soon in the Detroit plant. Chrysler paid back its loans. $7.5 billion gone, done. They're out of it. And now you got all these people who were the doomsdayers. It's the end. It's socialism. They're all lining up to take credit. Even Mitzi Romney, who called it tragic and advocated letting Detroit go bankrupt, even he wants to take credit for it. And in yesterday's New York Times, the Romney camp is now claiming that it was Mitzi's idea. He had it first. It was his idea. Now, you go back to that time, and you look at what Romney said, that Obama was wasting billions of dollars, they're just propping it up, it was going to fail, you should just let him go. Kiss, if basically saying if Obama does this, if the American taxpayer saves the auto industry in this country, saves an American auto industry, Romney's words, the bailout, you can kiss the American auto industry goodbye. It won't go overnight, he said, but then the demise will be virtually guaranteed. Now, you look at the reality is it's actually bounced back. A little bit of smart investment, sound policy, smart. And now you've got the flip-flopper, who Romney has become very flexible on most of his policies. First, he was for health care for everybody, which I agreed with. Now, he's against it. He was on the one side of the climate change, then he's on the other, on immigration. You name it, he's all over the place. In fact, he's been so far all over the place that former governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, observed that Romney is doing circus-like contortions to get out from under the damaging words he uttered in 2008, and it should come as no surprise. These people who were going to allow us to fail, who wanted this failure, let GM go under, let the American auto industry go, the Zach Womps of the world saying, well, you know, Tennessee's invested in automobiles. Volkswagen came in and invest in Tennessee, a right-to-work state with less benefits and less wages. Understand, that's the direction the Republicans want to take this country. They want business to come in and invest in an area where workers get screwed, where they don't make any money, where they don't have benefits. That quote should be on everyone's mind constantly. And yet we seem to forget that. We seem to forget that they were the people who were pushing for the end. These were the people who were pushing us down that road. Down the road to, they were, at the time they were talking about another 1 million to 2 million jobs gone. Granted, it would only be 100,000 in the direct auto industry, but all of those feeder plants, all of those ancillary plants, all of those restaurants and shops, all of that economic activity that would just be wiped away. That's what they were advocating for. Because they don't really believe in this country. They believe in the concept of free market business. It doesn't matter. And at the time, I was saying the fact that you've got a sitting congressman, you've got sitting senators in southern states who are advocating for foreign companies over American companies should be treasonous. The fact that Zach Womp was out there saying, you know, Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, you're right to work state, lower wages, less benefits. We should leave them alone, even though Tennessee gave Volkswagen $1 billion in welfare and in handouts and in land grants and in energy and in purchasing. Had they taken that $1 billion and said, you know what, we're going to invest in American car manufacturers. Had they been doing that all along as they've been giving out money to these foreign car companies to get these low-paying jobs in there, maybe we wouldn't have the problems we're in. You know, maybe if we weren't beating each other up in this country before we begin to go out into the global economy, maybe if we didn't have states beating each other up, this is this bizarre beggar thy neighbor economic development where here in Carlisle, Carlisle Tire and Wheel, and I'll never forget that, $34 million the state of Tennessee handed that company to move a company that had been in the area more than 90 years. More than 90 years to move it down to Tennessee. Why? Because they got $34 million. They got cheaper workers. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Greed. Politicians who are basing their reelection on being elected with money from these big corporations. And until we wake up and fight back against criminal budgets like the ones the Republicans here in Pennsylvania are trying to ram down our throats so that they can give out big tax handouts to corporations while starving and screwing their citizens. Until we wake up, we're going to keep getting what we deserve. We're right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW is defending public education in Michigan. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 10,000 people turned out in Lansing, Michigan on Saturday to protest Governor Rick Snyder's proposals to make drastic cuts to the state's education system. United Auto Workers President Bob King made an appearance to express the support of auto workers for teachers and students.
We are not spending too much on education in America. We're not spending too much on services to people. The truth is, we should be demanding more. We are not spending enough on education in America.
King said that what he was seeing in Lansing was the start of a new social movement, and he called on those in attendance to pledge to keep fighting. That sentiment was echoed by many of the speakers throughout the day, including Fruitport, Michigan School Board trustee Ben Gillette.
We cannot allow cuts in any one of these departments. We cannot allow them to put our children at risk with privatization. We must fight back against these cuts. And I'm not going to take it anymore, and I hope you're not going to take it either.
When these corporations get they want, have their merry way, there won't be a job left in the whole of the USA.
J.P. Wright's Music for Modern Railroaders speaks straight from the heart of railroad workers, drawing on the traditions of union music to tell modern working-class stories. The secretary-treasurer of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, Division 78, rides the rails between Louisville and Nashville. J.P.'s recorded music began with a joke, a variation on the old John Henry song.
We had this new technology where it was going to be replacing jobs, replacing an engineer with this little box. So I made a joke song about how the conventional engineer beat the remote control locomotive down, and people really liked it. Some of these themes are still around, but nobody's really writing any new music about it. And so that's really what I was trying to do, is make it more ours instead of a story from the past. The unions are so incredibly important to not just wages and safety and all the things that you would normally associate with the unions. It's the brotherhood and the family.
For more of J.P. Wright's music, go to railroadmusic.org.
We would sit down for supper. Well, my daddy, he would pray. Thank God and the union for our bread and butter today.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Sanity. Fresh Age. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, last night we talked with Robert Craig from Citizen Action Wisconsin, you know, about the 100 days since the Great Awakening in Wisconsin, when the citizens of Wisconsin realized that their governor was basically sticking it to them. And they came out in the streets and they organized and they did really an amazing job, which is why we went out and spent 9 days in Wisconsin to one, be part of history, but two, like I said before, to see what they had done right, where they had gone wrong, and to bring it back here to Pennsylvania for when we needed it. And again, there are so many great resources out there. Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together and for a Just and Sustainable Future by Linda Stout is a good book and a good place to start. She's an organizer, activist, as well as an author. Linda, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much.
I point to Wisconsin and I look at the organizing and basically spontaneous. It erupted almost overnight, but the organizations that have come out of that have followed a lot of the principles that you have here in your book, Collective Visioning. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things in your book?
Well, yes. I start off by talking about, because it's not just about collective visioning. It's how do we build a diverse group that, we may have different strategies of working for progressive social change, that we can come together to become more than the sum of our parts. And part of doing that is first beginning to create our trust with each other, create community with each other, build relationships, and then to vision what it is we really want, so that we're holding out that vision as a way of that can bring more people in instead of just talking about what we're against.
Right. You talk about in the book at length the fact that, and I think it's a really important part, and it was something we saw in Wisconsin, the fact that you have to talk about what you're for, what vision do you have for the future, not just what you're against here and now, because that kind of organizing kind of fizzles after time.
It certainly does, and we've seen that happen over and over. And it doesn't sustain people to stay in it, and it doesn't reach out with the values to people who might not necessarily be activists. So I think that's a really critical piece as well.
Yeah, because at the end of things, and a lot of groups that I've been a part of over the years, there's an energy at the beginning because there's a problem, we're going to solve this problem, we're going to fight back. And then over time, you see things kind of splintering away, factions developing, and it basically fizzles out.
Right, right. I've seen that over and over. And
how's the best way? How can we avoid some of those things? Because look, there are a lot of attacks going on here in the state of Pennsylvania, all across the country, where groups are, people are coming together, beginning to organize, and saying, we're going to take back our community. What pitfalls would you have people look out for?
Well, I think if we just focus on the problems and we feel this urgency, a lot of times groups say, well, we don't have time to stop and build relationships and community and trust and agreements about how we're going to work on this. Take the time to get everyone at the table, everyone into the room, and all the diversity that is included in a community or a region. And what I say is we have to do that first, and then our work can go much faster. So in the book, I lay out the steps that we need to think about in order to, I call it going slow to go fast, and then we can really move forward. And even in ups and downs, people can sustain themselves because they're bringing their whole self into this work and have built the relationships, and so it becomes community for them. And I think the right's been pretty smart about that, but they've done it in a very homogeneous kind of group. And while diversity is our greatest strength, it can be our challenge as well. So we have to learn how to come across cultures and across, not change the issues we work on, but connect the issues that we work on.
And find common ground.
And find common ground.
Example I would give is, there are a lot of things when the Tea Party thing started. I was right there at the beginning. I'm angry. I'm with you. All of the things that I've been told the last 20, 30 years, that if you work hard, play by the rules, you're going to be okay. The 401ks that they rammed down our throats, that were going to make us millionaires, didn't happen. I understood the anger. And I wanted to be part of that, but then it took a bizarre rightward turn. How do you reach out to groups like that where you have common ground? You have the anger of the common ground of all of the things that we held in common are now not true, but we've taken completely different paths towards solution.
Well, actually, I often say that people, especially low-income people and working-class people, are often they're not uneducated, they're miseducated and misled. And we have to hold out an equally strong, unified message to reach folks and build community that does connect to their values. I mean, I organized in rural North Carolina as the first multiracial organization in that region. And most of the white people who were poor white people who were part of our organization had been Jesse Helms voters. And what it took was us creating like an 8-foot report card showing people how that he voted on issues that concerned us as poor people. And people made a quick turnaround because they were like, oh, I thought he represented me, because that's what his ads always said.
Right.
But they hadn't been told or hadn't had the information to make an informed decision. And so I think that's a critical piece. And it's also critical that we create a culture among our organizations that everyone feels welcome.
And that's an excellent point. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Linda Stout. She's the author of Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future. We've got a link over at TheRickSmithShow.com on how you can get the book. Just click on Linda Stout's name. It'll take you right there. You know, Linda, you know, you reference seeing the elephant or the elephant poem in your book. Can you walk us through the meaning? I mean, I understand it, but I was hoping you'll walk us through a little bit of it.
Well, it's an exercise I often use, especially when I feel that there's people coming from all different directions and they're not talking about it. And I actually carry a whole bag full of all sizes of elephants and puppets and elephant toys and stuff. And I read the poem. It's an ancient poem that was written about 12 blind men who try to feel the elephant, and they all see it from different, or feel it from different perspectives. So one man feels the trunk and thinks it's a snake, or one man feels the leg and thinks it's a tree, and so forth and so on. So what I try to do is say we need to talk about all the issues and see ourselves as greater than the sum of the parts that we might think about. And so I lay out a theory of change, because we work in change in a lot of different ways. Some people work in reform, and there's those of us who work in organizing and changing the system, and there's those who are out creating alternatives, and, you know, the artists and musicians and the folks like your show that are trying to do the consciousness shift work to create change. So we have to do all of those things and work together to be a strong, unified movement.
Well, the reason I bring it up is, you know, one of the things that I talk about often is what the right has done, what the wealth class has done, is they've done a masterful job of slicing and dicing us up.
Exactly.
You're white, you're black, you're blue collar, you're white collar, male, female, the whole thing. And once they've been divided us up enough, they continue to divide even those sects up. And that's why I was thought it was interesting that you put it into the book, because I think that way you can start bringing people back together. Because I do believe at the end of the day, all of us have the same destination in mind. We want good schools. We want safe neighborhoods. We want a secure retirement. We want all of those, that American dream stuff. The difference is just how do we get there?
Right. And I think, you know, the idea of collective visioning, because, you know, there's been a lot talked about individual visioning, about getting what I want, or we, you know, my individual, what I want.
The whole Ayn Rand thing we're going through right
yeah.
now.
Yeah. And that's not sustainable for the earth or for people. If you have a few people who can vision all the wealth they want in the perfect house, then what does that mean for all the rest of us? And so it's why I use the word collective, because it's not a shared vision. It's not a common vision. It's all of our voices are there. And then we can look at the whole picture and say, okay, what can we work toward this year, and what can we make changes in? Because a vision is, one of the kids in New Orleans that I did visioning with said, well, all this is just pretend. And I said, you know, you're right, unless we have a plan to get there. And so that's a critical piece of it. But unless we've created the relationships, the trust, the, you know, I use storytelling a lot. I talk about that in the book. That gives us the strong base for us to work from. And, for example, I tell one story in my first book called Bridging the Class Divide, and 14 years later I finished the story in this book, Collective Visioning, because they held the vision that long and stuck together across tremendous opposition and people trying to split them up, and they didn't allow that to happen.
No. Let me ask you the last bit of question I've got for you, you know, and it's about you personally, because I know a lot of people, and the fact that you wrote these books really speaks well of you. Did you ever think that you would be an organizer, an activist, an author, the things that you've done? Because I talk to so many people who say, you know, I'd like to get involved. I'd like to do these things. I just can't.
Well, I was the first person in my family to graduate from high school. I did not graduate from college. And I never thought I could write. I never thought I could speak publicly. I never thought I could organize. And it was through my own passion, seeing the inequity and how it affected my family and my parents and how much shame got attached to that. And even for myself, about being poor, about not having a college degree, even though that had been my lifelong vision and dream, I wanted to be a teacher, that connected me with people who were trying to make change. And a lot of the movement at the time, the peace movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, is very middle-class white and not always welcoming to folks who are different cultures, even though they want to be.
Right.
So I also try to talk about that, about, well, how do you reach out and create a welcoming space that all voices can be heard? Because I think we have a sort of middle-class viewpoint that we do in a lot of our social justice organizing and don't even realize that we're cutting people out. And so I think that's really critical to how we create space and create welcoming and allow all voices to have equal power.
It is an excellent book, Collective Visioning, How Groups Can Work Together for a Just and Sustainable Future by Linda Stout, activist, organizer, and, of course, author. You can pick up the book. You can go to her website, lindastout.org, or you can go to the link at thericksmithshow.com and just click on Linda's name. It'll take you right there. Either way, a great book worth picking up. Linda, I appreciate the time. Keep
thank
up the great work.
So much.
And thank you so much. All right, we're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Billionaires are different from you and me for obvious reasons, including the fact that they buy much pricier baubles than we do. A sleek car costing $100,000? Well, that's just an impulse purchase. A few million bucks for a Matisse original? Go ahead, it'll liven up the hallway. How about throwing a fat wad of cash at a university to get an academic chair named for you? Sure, it's all part of living in billionaire land. Then there are megalomaniacal mega-billionaires like the Koch brothers. Using money from their industrial conglomerate, their foundation, and their personal fortunes, these two far-out laissez-faire extremists are literally buying public policy. Their purchases of everything from politicians to the Tea Party help them push the privatization of all things public and the elimination of pesky regulations and taxes that crimp their style. To advance their plutocratic cause, Brother Charles has gone on a shopping spree for an invaluable bauble that most of us didn't even know was for sale. Academic freedom. And it's surprisingly cheap. For only $1.5 million, Koch bought a big chunk of the economics department of Florida State University. His donation gives him control of a new academic program at this public institution to indoctrinate students in his self-serving political theories. The billionaire gets to screen all applicants, veto any he deems insufficiently ideological, and sign off on all hires. Also, the department head must submit yearly reports to Koch about the faculty's speeches, publications, and classes, and he evaluates the faculty based on objectives that he sets. This is Jim Hightower saying, Charles has made similar purchases of academic freedom at two other state universities, Clemson and West Virginia. Now just imagine the screams of outrage that you and I would be hearing from the Kochs if a labor union was doing this.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, Visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Time to change. Time to rearrange.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can also download our podcast at the website there for your entertainment and enjoyment. Andy Borowitz has a new Borowitz report out. He writes, one day after Representative Eric Cantor, Republican from Virginia, stirred controversy by withholding funds for tornado relief, the Federal Emergency Management Agency took the extraordinary step of declaring Representative Cantor a disaster area. Within hours of the declaration, FEMA officials were dispatched to assess the damage to Mr. Cantor's status as a human being capable of empathy. Tracy Klugen, FEMA's spokesperson, said, I've seen a lot of hurricanes and tornadoes, but this is something new. Representative Cantor appears to have been caught up in a moral vacuum. While concerned FEMA officials looked on, the morally ravaged House Majority Leader took to the floor of the House to make the case for denying funds to repair himself. The FEMA spokesperson said that the agency was currently trying to estimate the cost of rebuilding Mr. Cantor's soul. Frankly, Mr. Klugen said, I've never seen devastation like this. It's like there's nothing there. And again, you know, you stop and you think about this. The audacity. I mean, they're busting Obama's shoes for being overseas on a foreign policy trip. Yet you have got this, and there's no question that Obama is going to give, the administration is going to give Missouri whatever they need to rebuild. There's no question that they are going to be there to help that area recover. But when you've got Cantor, who's saying, you know what, we're not giving any money. We're not doing anything. We're not going to help them with these recover from these devastating storms in Missouri until we can make equal or greater spending cuts. Well, yesterday afternoon, one of his minions appeared on the House Appropriations Committee, and they passed an amendment by this Robert Alderholt, a Republican from Alabama, to add $1 billion in funding for FEMA by cutting $1.5 billion from the Advanced Technology Vehicles Manufacturing Loan Program with the Department of Energy. So what they're doing, again, you know, very short-sighted, they're cutting a program that's going to help us get off the juice, that's going to help our manufacturing, that's going to do a lot of good economic things, and they're slashing and burning that and holding us hostage to help those folks in Missouri. I'm dumbfounded by this whole thing. And the fact of the matter is the White House yesterday said that the federal government's only going to be buying vehicles that use alternative energy to equip their fleet by the end of 2015. This is the goal. The timeline that Obama has is to cut the U.S. imports of oil by a third here in the next 12 to 14 years. And he wants to put 1 million advanced vehicles on the road by 2015. And the U.S. government is the biggest fleet in the country. So if you can go down that road and you can get, you can replace the old gas guzzlers with fuel efficient electric or hybrid or natural gas or, you know, what electric, whatever. If you can replace those with more efficient cars, why not do that? Smart policy. But again, you know, you look at these folks, not too bright. And I argued right from the beginning that we should have done these kind of purchasing programs right from the very beginning. But, you know, the reality is we have a problem. And it's called Republicans. At the end of the day, it's their blind faith ideology in the quote-unquote free market to always make the right decision that somehow they're going to act in their best interest, that we have ended up in the position we're in. I don't know the last time the free market invested in a bridge. But I drove over one today that I am increasingly leery about. You know, I come into Harrisburg every day, and you know, you look at these bridges and you go, really? You know, how old is this bridge? Are there chunks of concrete falling off of it? I remember taking my kids to the zoo in Cleveland several years back, and they have now since replaced the bridge, but there were chunks of concrete falling off of the bridge. In fact, so frequently that they actually built a overpass over the road below it so that huge chunks of concrete would not hit cars as they were going by. But the Republican plan, again, is to stifle investment in the future. It's to cut off the ability to move us forward. And it's just angering. Some good news, though. Do you need some good news? Because I always could use a little good news. The good news is coming out of Charleston, West Virginia. The security chief at Massey Energy's Upper Big Branch mine, according to the AP, has pled not guilty after being charged with three federal crimes stemming from the nation's deadliest coal mine explosion. Again, this guy, Huey Stover, he entered the plea on Tuesday in a Beckley federal court, a grand jury investigating the explosion back on April 5th of 2010, added one charge against the 59-year-old security guard, in this updated indictment. He was indicted last February, you may remember, of lying to the FBI and lying to the Federal Mine Safety Health Administration, as well as obstruction of justice. The prosecutors are saying that this Stover ordered subordinates to throw away thousands of pages of security documents at the mine there. And, you know, I look at this and I go, well, here's one guy who's going to go to jail. He's going to. But what about the others? I mean, this is one security guard. This is one of their, you know, one of the underlings. When's Blankenship going? When are the board of directors going? When are the people who kept pushing the policies that caused the situation to put these 29 people who lost their lives in a situation where they couldn't get out? And we see report after report that unionized mines are much safer than these fly-by-night operations who have people who are just saying, run to coal. I don't know if you've seen this TV show called Coal. I've watched it a couple of times, and it's amazing to me, even in the show, how they're balancing the safety of the people over the costs. You know, at the one episode I saw, they had this broken down machine that kept breaking down, and they're sending people in to kind of dig it out while huge chunks of rock are falling off the ceiling. And the guy's explaining, he goes, you know, you get hit in the back with this, it's all over. Game over. And the guys are, I mean, how morbid is it? You go to work and you go, today I could get hit by this rock and it'd be the end of it. My family be done. I don't know. What's it going to take? Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Reed Mackey, coordinator of Child Labor Coalition at the National Consumer League, about their new report that's come out, the five most dangerous jobs for teens in 2011, right back after this. Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children. to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job. They're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the way it is. Everything's raisin, but the way it is. Gasoline, groceries, and our haters. Everything's raisin, but the way it is.
And, you know, the thing is if you give... If you give the right there the chance, they're going to put kids into the workforce, and the wages will come down even further because now you got your 14, 15-year-olds competing with mom and dad for that job at McDonald's or worse. And, you know, I've seen across the country, you've seen a number of these Republican-led state legislatures just getting out of control. I mean, I look at that bill in Missouri that Senator Jane Cunningham put out, basically eliminating all protections for children, basically taking us back to the good old days of the 1890s, where children were the main supporters. You know, it's insane. You look what's going on up in Maine, another crazy idea up there. I don't know why more people weren't outraged. I was. Fortunately, I wasn't the only one. The National Consumers League, they were outraged as well, and they put out their latest report titled Five Most Dangerous Jobs for Teens 2011, and here to talk about the report is Reed Mackey. He's the coordinator of the Child Labor Coalition at the National Consumers League. NCLnet.org is their website. There's also a link at ours at thericksmithshow.com. Reed, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for inviting me.
You know, walk me through this. You know, some of these jobs that you've got on the list, like forklift operator, I didn't know teens could do.
Well, they aren't in all industries allowed to drive forklifts, but there are a lot of exemptions to agriculture where 16 and 17-year-olds can drive forklifts only in agriculture. And we actually see a fair number of deaths and injuries because of that. You know, they just don't have the training or the experience, and the forklifts tend to tip over.
Or the maturity. The maturity of the thing. You know, if when I was 15, you put me on a forklift, it'd be like a dune buggy.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, there's attendance, there's horseplay, and that factors into some of the accidents as well.
So walk me through some of this stuff, because, you know, I want kids, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I did lawn cutting jobs. I, you know, worked at the fast food place for a little bit. You want kids to have jobs, but you also want them to grow up and be old.
That's absolutely right. You know, we think that it's good for kids' development to work, but there should be limits on the amount of work they can do. And the environment should be safe because we don't want our kids getting hurt on the job. And right now, you know, there are still too many kids getting hurt. Although the death rates have been falling, about every 2 weeks, a working teen dies on the job. And, you know, for those 27 families last year, that was just an absolutely devastating tragedy for them to endure. We don't think it's necessary because a lot of the kids are dying in jobs that where proper safety precautions aren't being taken.
So, you know, here's the thing, and, you know, I look at this Jane Cunningham bill out of Missouri that basically just strips all oversight by the state, basically saying children can be exploited, children can do just about any job according to this bill. And now, it didn't go anywhere, but the thought was there. This is dangerous stuff.
I've also heard that the state budget took out all of the money for the child labor inspectors.
Really?
So even though the bill didn't go anywhere, there won't be any enforcement of child labor laws in the state, which, you know, could lead to injuries down the road.
Now, have we learned nothing? from our history. I mean, I go back and I read stories about the breaker boys in the coal industry and a lot of the kids working on farms and stuff. And you read about this history and you go, at some point, don't we have to learn those lessons or do we have to learn them again?
I think you're absolutely right. Recently, a lot of folks commemorated the Triangle Fire in New York City, where, you know, a lot of young workers died because there were almost no safety precautions. It was back in the day when there was no regulatory protections, and employers did what they wanted.
Right.
And they didn't care about, they didn't want to spend money to protect their workers.
A number of the jobs that you pointed out are in agriculture. Is some of it, and maybe you'll have a better understanding than I do, my thought is that, maybe some of that was carved out for family farms. Maybe some of that was cut out because, you needed the younger workers on the family farms to keep things going. But how many family farms do we still have running?
Well, that's a really good question. The number of family farms has been shrinking. And when these exemptions for agriculture were put in place in the 1930s, the economy was so different. Agriculture was such an important part. There was less mechanization. I don't think that you can justify sending 12-year-olds into the fields to work 10, 12-hour days in 100-degree heat any longer. I mean, if they're not allowed to work in any other industry, why should they be allowed to work in agriculture?
When I was a kid, you couldn't get a job before you were 16. I'm starting to see that relaxing a lot, especially in the fast food industry, which I think is a fairly dangerous industry for immature teens.
I totally agree. The fast food industry didn't make our list of the five most dangerous jobs, but it actually has one of the highest rates of injury. The actual number of injuries is among the highest. That's where a lot of kids are getting hurt. The injuries tend not to be as lethal as some of these other industries that are on our list, but I would definitely want to talk to my kid if he was going to go work in a fast food restaurant and talk to the manager, ask him about what safety training the kids go through.
And one of the things you put on here is a traveling youth sales crew. What hazards do you see in that?
Well, these are crews of mostly young people. They tend to be 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, although we do see some minors. And they're going around often selling magazines or knives door-to-door, and it's just a very dangerous industry. As you can imagine, you hear all these stories about child abduction and assaults, and people are knocking on the doors of strangers, which is dangerous enough, and they're going inside the houses. But they're also working on these crews where when the police run checks on these crews, they find that a lot of the members of the crews have criminal records. And, there's a group out in Wisconsin that's been tracking crimes that are involved in these traveling sales crews, and the number is just stunning. The number of murders and rapes and assaults that are associated with these door-to-door sales teams, and I'm not talking about, the high school kid in your community that's knocking on the door in his neighborhood,
right,
but I'm talking about people who go from state to state and do this, day in and day out for months on end. The crime rates are just really high.
Yeah, one of the other things you put on are construction and height work. I don't know how many kids are doing that. Are they working with their companies? What's that all about?
Well, in a lot of states, you start to see 16-year-olds working legally in construction, and it is a very dangerous industry. The death rates are about three times what other industries are, and there tend to be a lot of deaths from falling from heights and getting hit by objects, encountering machinery. And, we're not categorically saying that teenagers shouldn't do construction, but we just want to make sure that, they wear their safety harnesses when they're on heights and that they do receive proper safety training. And, if they have other alternatives that are safer, that they think about, doing those other jobs.
Yeah, the parents have an idea of what's going on, because I got to be honest, the more I'm seeing, the thing in Missouri actually shocks me that they've completely defunded the enforcement of it. So basically the law that really outrageous law that they put forth, is now, I guess, the rule of the land, because nobody's enforcing what they do have on the books.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Without enforcement, employers are going to get lax. They're going to become lazy. They're going to stop obeying the law. They'll be hiring, underage kids. They won't be following safety procedures. I'm not saying all, you know, there are a lot of good employers out there that care about safety and kids, but it's just human nature that if you're not, you know, not compelled to do certain things that cost money, you're probably not going to do them.
Let me ask you this, Reed Mackey, for the parents who have kids, because I do encourage teenagers to get jobs. I've had numerous jobs as a kid. What advice do you give to people in looking for work for summers?
Well, you know, I would definitely try to stay away from the jobs that we've already talked about. You know, I've had a conversation with folks from the Centers for Disease Control, and their advice is whenever your kid is working with machinery, you know, you should be careful. You should ask questions about how safe is that machinery. We had a young boy here in Virginia last year who was working, he shouldn't have been, he was illegally working, with his foster dad on a wood chipper. And, within an instant, the chipper, grabbed the shovel that he was loading, you know, kind of cramming stuff into the wood chipper and sucked him in. He was gone in an instant.
Wow.
And, you know, he just had no idea that that kind of danger existed. So my advice would be that, you should really talk to your kid and you know, they're entering the work world. They have no idea what dangers are lurking in these jobs they've never had before. You know, they don't know that, you know, if they go into a grain silo that they may suffocate, under a mountain of grain, which happens every year to a handful of kids. So have that conversation and empower them to talk to their boss and ask about safety training and ask about safety equipment and empower them to say, no, I don't want to do that. That job sounds, you know, that task sounds too dangerous. Yep. I think maybe you should ask an adult to do that.
Excellent.
It's hard for a kid to do that, though.
Oh, and it is, but you got to give them the ability to stand up for themselves. The report is Five Most Dangerous Jobs for Teens 2011 by the folks over at the National Consumers League. There's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Reed Mackey's name. It'll take you right there. Reed, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the report. Thanks so much.
Rick, thank you.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One place I won't be, I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
You helped to turn America blue. Now let's keep it that way. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the time. This is the place for the future. There's not much left to go around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. You know, looking at the presidential, the march up to 2012, I'm looking at Newt Gingrich. It doesn't appear as though he's on the presidential stump anymore. It doesn't seem like he's on the stump tour. It looks like he's simply on a speaking tour. Because this morning he was in New Hampshire, and, you know, he gave his little spiel. He told the news media he'd speak to them individually afterwards, and then he bolted, basically leaving his handler there in a fairly awkward position, saying no questions today. And I got to be honest, who'd blame him? I mean, who'd blame the guy after the thumping the Republicans took in New York yesterday over Ryan's budget plan to destroy Medicare? And, you know, you got to be honest, you know, Newt, to his credit, he called it what it is. It's right-wing social engineering. It's this bizarre right-wing plot to take us back to the good old days of the 19th century. And then there's this Tiffany story that I don't think has gotten enough play. It's gotten a little bit of play, maybe not enough. And it keeps getting more interesting the more I look into it. Turns out he and his wife, Callista, they showed about $500,000, in revolving credit at the store Tiffany's and Company. They're the big high-priced jewelry place. Now look, I understand the Newtster. He makes a good bit of coin. You make a good, when you're shilling for the right, when you're shilling for the billionaire class, they're going to take care of you. He writes those crummy books that no one really reads. You know, the think tank buys a pallet or two of them, you know, gives them away or stores them in a warehouse somewhere. He gives those speeches. They take care of him. So either way, he's going to do all right. He's got some coin in his pocket. You just keep up the shill game. He'll be fine. What is interesting, though, is with this upwards of $500,000 that they have in debt to Tiffany's, what we're finding out now is that his wife was working on the House committee that evidently Tiffany's was lobbying. So at a time when she's working on the committee, this corporation is heavily lobbying the people that she worked for. Last week, in fact, Politico reported that in her 2005-2006 filings with the House Ethics Committee, Callista Gingrich disclosed that Newt had somewhere between $250,000 and $500,000 with debt with Tiffany's while she was working for the House Agriculture Committee. Now, if you remember over the weekend, Newt came out and said, it's a standard no-interest account. He said we paid no interest on it. There was no problem with it. It was a normal way of doing business. In fact, he went on to say that, well, if you had someone running the government like I run my accounts, we'd be much better off. And I'll come back to that in a second because, you know, I got to think about this for a minute. But during the time that this 2005-2006 time period where this upwards of half a million dollar debt to Tiffany's is out there, and, you know, they had to report it to the Ethics Committee, Tiffany's doubled the amount of money they were spending on lobbying, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. They spent in 2006 about $200,000 alone. And you go, well, what could Tiffany's possibly be lobbying for? Well, turns out the lobbying firm Cassidy and Associates, they reported that they were mining, they were lobbying on behalf of mining law and mine permitting. Understand that Tiffany's is well known for its silver jewelry. Here's one of those, you gotta wonder. And there's nothing on the Newtster's website about it. Nothing about the missus being involved in any mining. And in fact, according to her bio, doesn't say anything about mining. What it does say is, quote, during her tenure, the Agricultural Committee held hearings on a wide range of issues, including biotechnology, bioterrorism, conservation, forest management, nutrition, rural development, trade, and welfare reform. Nothing about mining, especially nothing about silver mining. Now, the disclosure by this lobbyist firm, Cassidy and Associates, lists the former Gingrich legislative assistant, Christy Evans, as one of the people that was a lobbyist for this organization. So there's a lot of really funny ties here. And in the Washington Post, Glenn Kessler, he points out that the account that they're talking about, this account that is, according to Newt, a standard way of doing, a standard no-interest account. There's no problem with it. It's just a normal way of doing business, according to Newt. What Kessler's saying is, you know, you look at their application, and it's anything but. He says, you know, in looking at the rates, you would have a 21% interest rate on any person getting a Tiffany's credit account who lived in Virginia, which is where Gingrich and his wife live. He goes on to say that any normal person, that interest would be a hefty charge, about $50,000 on a $250,000 loan. So you're looking at pocket change. And what I find kind of weird is that people at creditcards.com also told the Washington Post that, you know, it doesn't sound plausible that he would get this kind of credit. He goes on to say that store credit cards will never carry these kind of terms, and it's highly unlikely that an exclusive retailer like Tiffany's would do it. So you got to ask the question, what's the Newtster getting? What kind of special treatment that you and I don't get? So when he says, you know, if you ran the government like I run my personal accounts with these, what's appearing to be a very special favor, and you got to wonder if it was a quid pro quo situation where, you know, maybe Mrs. Newt, you know, took on a, hey, I love this, let me have this, and you know, whatever. You got to ask the question. I mean, because if Newt's saying there's no interest, it's a standard bit of doing business, but the Tiffany's people are saying, well, no. Their literature is saying 21% interest. You got to wonder. You got to wonder how you get this special kind of treatment, because as president, you're not going to get that special kind of treatment. When foreign countries buy our bonds, they're not going to go, Newt, we like you so much, we're not going to want any return on that. It's just not how things are done. And the thing that bothers me is I never get that kind of special treatment. When it's me, I always get the, well, sorry, it's normally we charge 21%, but for you, it's going to be 30%. Me, personally, I always get stuck next to this woman. There was an Amtrak train running from, I guess it was Oakland to Portland. And this woman talked on her cell phone the entire 16 hours. In fact, they stopped the train at a point and took her off of the train because she was on her phone for 16 hours in a designated quiet car, which I find would be my luck. I would be next to that woman the whole way. I never get special treatment. But, you know, the Newtster, yeah, $500,000, interest-free, thinks it's a standard way of doing business. Insane. Just insane. The president has this. One of the things he put out during the 2009 Recovery Act was this idea that we're going to build our infrastructure. And he's proposing a package of about $556 billion in spending. Because we need roads, we need bridges, we need a lot. I mean, if you've looked at our infrastructure, it is crumbling. And in the next 2 weeks, the Senate's going to begin talking about, well, let's see, you know, how much money can we afford over the next 6 years for our transportation. And according to the Environment and Public Works Committee Chairwoman Barbara Boxer, they're looking at about $339 billion over the next 6 years, which is a huge drop in what the president's asking for. Now, the Senate, right now, they're considering a standalone bill to create a national infrastructure bank, which the president has been pushing for since he was running for office. They're saying they're going to appropriate about $5 billion a year, which I got to be honest, in the reports that I've seen and the studies that I've seen that talk about the need for investment in our infrastructure being somewhere in the multiple trillions, $5 billion a year, not going to cut it. You're basically going to just continue to sink just at a slower path. But Obama, you know, initially, he wanted to spend $53 billion on high-speed rail. That, I guess, is going to be separate legislation. Boxer and them are going to try and push some of that through. I don't see the Republicans going for it. Again, you know, a lost opportunity in 2009. They went and they gave away all kind of tax breaks. They went and they gave away 40% of the 800 and some billion dollars. They gave that out in tax breaks instead of saying, you know what, here's a good time to build roads and bridges and high-speed rail. Anyway, a single question that has loomed for some time is the last $285 billion of the five-year authorization that expired in 2009. How is the country going to pay for transportation projects moving forward? How are we going to fill that gap? And according to experts at the University of Virginia, the gap between sources of funding for transportation infrastructure and the spending levels needed to maintain and improve it is somewhere around $135 billion. That's what we need annually. That's the minimum we need annually just to maintain and do some improvements. Now, where we get our money for transportation is through the gas tax. Everybody hates paying the gas tax, which right now stands somewhere around a little over 18 cents a gallon. And it hasn't gone up in decades. And I agree, you know, the president's saying now's not the time to start talking about upping the gas tax because that's going to kill working people. But what we should be looking at, a progressive tax structure as opposed to these regressive ones. Saying, you know, folks, the people who are doing really well, those are the people you go after. The folks on Wall Street who are transferring stocks at such an alarming rate, maybe put a small transfer tax on it. Maybe do some things that are going to move us down the road to having some sanity. You know, I had this long conversation with my dentist this morning. I alluded to earlier. And, you know, when you sit and you talk about stuff and you have that back and forth, there's an opportunity to reach some common ground. And as far off to the extreme right as I think he is, we did make some common ground. This country needs investment. If we're going to maintain the wealth that we've attained, if we're going to maintain superpower status, if we're going to maintain this exceptional status that we love to, you know, pump our chest out and bang like Tarzan, we better start investing in it. These things, once they crumble, once they fall, much harder rebuilding. Look at the fact now, the House of Representatives, they haven't even begun to introduce their legislation on what to do with transportation spending. Nothing there. And I suspect, and again, I go back to this, I suspect it's going to be more of this public-private investment. We want to use public money, we'll build the stuff and let private interests take care of it and profit from it. That seems to be the game plan. This whole privatization scheme that they love ramming down our throats that doesn't work, hasn't worked, probably never going to work, but at the end of it, that's their blind faith ideology. So in order for us to get a road or a bridge or a high-speed rail, it's going to have to be our money investing in something that the billionaire class is going to invest in, which is why we don't have solar panels on every house. They haven't figured out how to profit off of it. They haven't figured out how to have investors make a boatload of bucks off of it and charge us for the electricity that's generated from the solar panels on our own houses. Once they figure that out, man, it's a done deal. Anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Multi-billions in this country get not a dime to spare.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The UAW is defending public education in Michigan. Jesse Russell reports.
More than 10,000 people turned out in Lansing, Michigan on Saturday to protest Governor Rick Snyder's proposals to make drastic cuts to the state's education system. United Auto Workers President Bob King made an appearance to express the support of auto workers for teachers and students.
We are not
spending too much on education in America. We're not spending too much on services to people. The truth is we should be demanding more. We are not spending enough on education in America.
King said that what he was seeing in Lansing was the start of a new social movement, and he called on those in attendance to pledge to keep fighting. That sentiment was echoed by many of the speakers throughout the day, including Fruitport, Michigan School Board Trustee Ben Gillette.
We cannot allow cuts in any one of these departments. We cannot allow them to put our children at risk with privatization. We must fight back against these cuts. And I'm not going to take it anymore, and I hope you're not going to take it either.
When these corporations get the one, have their merry way, there won't be a job left in the whole of the USA.
J.P. Wright's Music for Modern Railroaders speaks straight from the heart of railroad workers, drawing on the traditions of union music to tell modern working-class stories. The secretary-treasurer of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, Division 78, rides the rails between Louisville and Nashville. J.P.'s recorded music began with a joke, a variation on the old John Henry song.
We had this new technology where it was going to be replacing jobs, replacing an engineer with this little box. So I made a joke song about how the conventional engineer beat the remote control locomotive down, and people really liked it. Some of these themes are still around, but nobody's really writing any new music about it. And so that's really what I was trying to do, is make it more ours instead of a story from the past. The unions are so incredibly important to not just wages and safety and all the things that you would normally associate with the unions. It's the brotherhood and the family.
For more of J.P. Wright's music, go to railroadmusic.org.
We would sit down for supper. Well, my daddy, he would pray. Thank God and the union for our bread and butter today.
This newscast made possible in part by the American Federation of Teachers, a union of professionals. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Official supporter of Palin Santorum 2012, The Rick Smith Show.
You know, that's what they're doing. They're running with the devil. Pat Toomey, another, the Ryan budget to Toomey was maybe just a little too extreme. So he put out his own extreme budget, that he tried to sell as, the Ryan light. You know, this is insane light. It got shot down today, 42-55. All but three Republicans voted for it. No Democrat. So what was to be the light budget, the one that was still going to destroy Social Security, still going after it, still going after that, still taking them down, create a fast track scenario, so that Social Security could be cut, so the retirement age could be raised to 69 or God knows where, to take $1.4 trillion from Medicaid again. This whole idea, it was never about Medicare. Understand that. They threw that out there to divest again. And they do that really well. They throw out these really outrageous proposals like House Bill 916. The more way out on the fringe, the more we get upset and go, that's just nuts. And then you get another Republican to come in like Toomey was trying to do and go, well, here's nuts light. And then people go, oh, well, that's better. Much like Corbett's budget. Way out on the extreme, cutting 56% to higher education, over $1 billion to K-12, cutting programs for seniors, cutting, and in come the Republicans who just shuffled around the deck chairs on the Titanic and said, here's better. We restored some some of the, we restored some of the money to education. Love us. Without saying, hey, folks, you still cut money to education. And who'd you steal it from? Well, you stole it from those 30 people who showed up today at the Capitol in their wheelchair. Not to mention, and this is the part that just galls me to no end, the Toomey budget plan, the big budget plan that's going to solve our problems in 9 years, balance the budget, was still going to give over $1 trillion in handouts to the top 2%. Going to take that top tax rate and that top corporate tax rate down from 35% down to 25%. I mean, granted, they're not paying the 35%. They're not even paying the 25% now. It's just nuts. And now we've got a presidential candidate who I don't think he's a presidential candidate much anymore. I think the reality is Polente's ship has already sunk with the story of the child molester that he let go. The one that he swiped his record clean so he could go and molest his own 9-year-old daughter another 250 times. But, you know, Polente's still out there plugging away. And what is he saying? Well, we need to cut Social Security, not defense. We don't need to do anything to rein in the bloated defense spending. We do anything to rein that in. What we need to do, according to our boy Polente here, is go after those greedy geezers. You old people who think that just because you paid into a system and just because we, the federal government, made a promise to you that we're going to actually keep it. At some point, don't we have to start and say, leave Social Security alone? I mean, they've really done a great job. You give them credit. They've done a great job of convincing people younger than me. And even I sometimes question whether Social Security is going to be there when I get to be 65. Or 67, I guess that's where I'm at now. Eventually they'll get me up to 69 or 75 or 100 or, you know, maybe the way. But, you know, they've done a masterful job of convincing the younger generation that, well, you know, it's all gone. It's just worthless pieces of paper in a filing cabinet. Just I'll use. And it's not going to be there when the younger generations go to retire, which is, you know, a decision that we're making right now. If we do nothing, to change this system, yes, I do believe that in 50, 75 years, you're going to see a majorly reduced benefit. It's going to be, you know, less than you're getting now. From what I understand, the numbers, you know, take us out another 20 years of paying 100% and then drop off a little bit. Now, to listen to the right tell the story, 20 years, it's all broke. The system just ends. Everything stops. The wheels grind to a halt. The cogs snap off the wheel. And it's not true. But they keep putting that out there, hoping that we'll believe it, so that we'll do what they want us to do. We'll pass some kind of insane law that will give them the ability to take over the system and put it into Wall Street where they can really profit from it. Because that's the Wall Street wet dream. You know, making banks, gambling casinos, that was a fantasy. That was, yeah, hey, if we got that, we can make a boatload of money. But getting a hold of Social Security, getting that trust fund, getting that pot, to them, that would be Christmas every day. That would be like a 5-year-old waking up and Santa just brought every toy he wanted every single day of his life. That's how Wall Street would see this pot of gold. And do you not think that they would continually, you know, like a 5-year-old with his hand in the cookie jar, keep taking and taking until you go, oops, it's all gone? Much like Republican presidents have been doing for the last 30 years with the Social Security cookie jar. The Reagan administration, they created this thing just so they could steal from it, just so they could hide their budget deficits. And they did a great job of it. They took all this money in, so we'll put it in the trust fund. It's going to be there for when the pig goes through the python. Well, you know what? The pig's being eaten by the python right now, and the money's not there because they borrowed it. They spent it on Star Wars, and they spent it on wars, and they spent it on building projects and investments and smart things. But for the most part, they spent a lot of it on missile defense systems that nobody thought would ever work and on these misadventures all around the world. That's where your Social Security money is. But to hear them tell the story, well, you know, It was just, you know, we offered too generous of benefits. And that couldn't be further from the truth. They mismanaged it. They blew it. And they don't want to pay it back. The trillions of dollars that they've taken from the fund, and they don't want to pay it back. Because that would mean raising taxes on the wealthy. The people who give them money to run their campaigns. And it all comes back to that key point. The fact that we don't have campaign finance laws in this country that rein in the kind of obscene spending that goes on in these campaigns. And I don't care which side of the aisle you're on. Obama ran the campaign against McCain with just money that would blow your mind. It shouldn't be about that. It should be about what direction does this country go? Do we want to have a strong safety net? And if you look at this collapse that happened under Bush in September of 2008, had it not been for even the tattered, worn, withered safety net that we still have in this country, had it not been for that safety net, we would have plummeted into the abyss. This country would have collapsed. But because of unemployment insurance that helped pay the bills, that helped put food on the table, that tied a lot of people over until they could find a job. Because if you remember, we were losing several hundred thousand jobs a month, even before Obama took office. I think the month he took office, in the full month of February, I think we lost 700,000 jobs. I think in January they lost 600,000 or 700,000 jobs. December, several hundred thousand. Before any policy that they put into place, we lost millions of jobs. We were plummeting and fast. But the reason people didn't hit the ground hard is we had this safety net, this elasticity that helped us kind of hold ourselves from the concrete. And sick people got to get Medicaid. And we had food stamps, and we had the ability to help people and to make sure that we didn't have the mass suffering. And now what you've got here in this state is you've got people who want to destroy the thing that saved us. You know, when you talk about unemployment insurance, and I wish we could be forward-looking. I wish we could be forward-looking on all of our policies and run our government the way I run my kitchen table, if we have to use the kitchen table. When times are good, you squirrel some money away. You kind of rein in your spending when times are good, and you save for that rainy day. And then when it rains, you've got a couple of bucks, so your median standard of living is pretty constant. What we do in this country is, we have times are great, it's party time! Hand out all the spoils to the very wealthy. Here you go, take more, here's some more, don't forget this! And when it's bad, we start talking about, we need to cut. We need to cut, 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 cut. So we have these massive hills and valleys for the people at the bottom. The wealthy, they're always fine. They're going to be fine, thank you very much. It's you, the working stiff, who gets screwed. For me, unemployment insurance should be a plan, and this would help employers as well. And I think this is a plan to start with. What you do is you have an unemployment system that says, you know what? We're going to guarantee a median income. When you, the working people, and this is a collaboration not only between workers and their companies, but workers, their companies, their government, a whole kind of thing together. That when companies are struggling and they've got to lay off or they've got to cut back because, you know, times are down, we don't have a spiraling down of the economy. We have something that buoys us up, that helps us. So if a plant has 100 employees and they've only got work for 75, well, you know, maybe they cut back 25% of the hours for everybody. And then everybody collects a little bit of unemployment so that your wages don't fall very much. Everybody shares in the sacrifice, and everybody still has money in their pocket to continue to pay their bills and consume and keep other businesses employed. Not hooray for me and screw a bunch of everybody else, which is the way the system is now. have a system that when times are good, we pay a little bit more into the unemployment system. And you know what? Here's a novel concept. Leave it there. Don't feel the need to go and spend it on other things. Invest it for that. And not in Wall Street. Because when Wall Street collapses is when we have these major economic downturns that make us turn to having social safety net programs. But we're never going to think forward like that. We're never going to think beyond the next downturn. We're just not. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Billionaires are different from you and me. For obvious reasons, including the fact that they buy much pricier baubles than we do. A sleek car costing $100,000? Why, that's just an impulse purchase. A few $1 million for a Matisse original? Go ahead, it'll liven up the hallway. How about throwing a fat wad of cash at a university to get an academic chair named for you? Sure, it's all part of living in billionaire land. Then there are megalomaniacal mega-billionaires like the Koch brothers. Using money from their industrial conglomerate, their foundation, and their personal fortunes, these two far-out laissez-faire extremists are literally buying public policy. Their purchases of everything from politicians to the Tea Party help them push the privatization of all things public and the elimination of pesky regulations and taxes that crimp their style. To advance their plutocratic cause, Brother Charles has gone on a shopping spree for an invaluable bauble that most of us didn't even know was for sale. Academic freedom, and it's surprisingly cheap. For only $1.5 million, Koch bought a big chunk of the economics department of Florida State University. His donation gives him control of a new academic program at this public institution to indoctrinate students in his self-serving political theories. The billionaire gets to screen all applicants, veto any he deems insufficiently ideological, and sign off on all hires. Also, the department head must submit yearly reports to Koch about the faculty's speeches, publications, and classes, and he evaluates the faculty based on objectives that he sets. This is Jim Hightower saying, Charles has made similar purchases of academic freedom at two other state universities, Clemson and West Virginia. Now just imagine the screams of outrage that you and I would be hearing from the Kochs if a labor union was doing this.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I like it. That could be our new 2012 presidential campaign official music for coming in with the insanity of these bizarre candidates like Rick Santorum, like Bachman, like Pawlenty, who I think is already done. I think Gingrich is done. I think most of them are already done. The guy who I think, again, mark my words on this, Chris Christie's going to enter the race. I think he's going to be the guy. I don't think Romney's got the shot. Although I think, and this is, I hate saying it, if there had to be a Republican win, I think Romney would be the sane candidate. But I just don't see it happen. I see the radical fringe of the Republican Party taking over, especially in the primaries, and basically giving them someone who's just plain nuts. And then they will get behind just plain nuts. That's just how it's going to be. I don't know if you saw this, Texas has got a whole bunch of problems. They've got huge budget deficits. They've got public schools are facing massive, massive spending cuts. But yet the legislature there in Texas, they want to make sure that noodling is legal. And I didn't know what noodling was. And this is what caught my eye. I go, noodling. Wow, I wonder, you know, is spaghetti illegal down there? Do they have something against the Italians like they have against the French? I don't know. So I read into this, and it turns out that noodling, which, again, I have no idea how you come up with noodling as the name. And if there are any Southerners out there who can explain it to me, I would love to hear about it. But I guess it's this, it's a Southern practice of catching catfish by hand. What you do is you stick your hand down in their holes. And when they bite you, then you grab them. Seems kind of dumb to me. In fact, seems really dumb to me. But I guess what they're calling hillbilly hand fishing is something that people in Texas want. I can't imagine, but you know, and I say God bless them. And thank God for the Texas legislature who could care less about those kids and about that budget. They just want to make sure that those two or three people in the state who are dumb enough to put their hand in a hole to get bitten can do it legally and without repercussion from the tyrannical government who was charging them $500 per noodle. But I loved it. Hillbilly hand fishing. The one representative said, you gotta love this. You don't know if there's anything in the hole at all. You run your hands down into that hole, and all of a sudden the fish comes out and bites you. And you have to try and bring it out with your hand. That, my friends, that's hillbilly hand fishing. Man, you know, I got to tell you, I am kind of waiting for Texas to leave. And good luck, Mexico. You deal with them. Also, the feds have come out and said that the anti-groping law that Texas wanted to pass, basically saying that, you know, if the TSOs do their job, the people at the screeners do their job and pat people down, that it was going to be a misdemeanor charge against these folks. Could even go up to a felony at such point. If the feds are saying, if you pass this, we're going to cancel all flights into Texas. That's the end of it. And they have the power to do it. So they've, I guess, pulled back the bill. The state senator, Dan Patrick, who is the guy who was putting this forth, he gave in. He withdrew the bill, but only after insisting that he wouldn't cave to the federal government. He wasn't going to cave to those heavy-handed threats by those feds. Either way, he pulled the bill. But, you know, wow, just insanity. I came across this really good piece by a guy named Matthew Desmond over at Addicted to Info. And he asked the question, what has the Tea Party accomplished? And, you know, he got a couple of interesting responses. Because if you remember, and I thought when the Tea Party started, and I could have been, and I've said this a number of times, I could have quite easily been one of those people out there. I wouldn't have had the old costumes and the trifold hat and all that, and the wigs. You know, that's just not me. But, hey, God bless you if you do it. But I was there at the beginning. You know, I was saying, you know, I was angry. I was ticked off. We're getting screwed as a working class. This is working class solidarity. This is people rising up, taking over. You know, this is our country, damn it, and we're going to fight for it. And then they just got all crazy. And this Matthew Desmond goes into a couple of points that I think are important. What has the Tea Party accomplished, really, honestly, and truthfully? And the reality is what they did is they accomplished massive tax cuts for the top 2% of the people in this country. We gave a big boatload of money to the investor class so that we could extend unemployment benefits for the folks who were being kicked and down on the ground. Also, the Tea Party gave us this fresh group of ideologically driven purists who had no freaking clue how government works. Have no clue of civics. They have this bizarre talk radio version of how history used to be in the country, and that's how we're gonna take the country back to liberty and freedom. Whatever the hell that means. But you got to give them credit. You know, they did sweep in. Still not sure what they're doing yet. Still haven't found their way to the bathroom yet, but they're still collecting a lot of money. They're doing a lot of fundraising, which, again, if you remember, they were kind of against. Also, the Tea Party brought us a whole bunch of attacks on women's rights. And again, you know, this whole idea that, you know, the Tea Party ran on this principle of smaller government. States' rights, smaller government. Yeah, we need more of that. We need women to be barefoot and pregnant in the house. Taking us back to the good old theological days. Because this country was founded on Christian principles. Which, again, they weren't. But, you know, they, again, bought into the whole talk radio version of what America was. This is America, damn it. You're going to follow America. The other thing that the Tea Party did is they made Sarah Palin a celebrity. They made her a media darling. To wherever she went, the media had to put her in the spotlight because these minions were buying this stuff. And, of course, the mainstream media is going to give you the shiny thing that you want. And every time she says something stupid or she, you know, does something dumb, they cover it and people say, oh, she's like one of us. She's stupid like us. The other thing that the Tea Twizzlers did, and you got to give them credit for this, absolutely, you got to give them credit, they helped the Democrats keep the majority in the Senate. They really did. I mean, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, really? Anybody going to argue with me that the Tea Party didn't cost the Republicans that seat? No. Anybody going to argue that Sharon Engel didn't save Harry Reid in Nevada? Anyone? How about Ken Buck in Colorado? Am I going to make it the argument that Michael Bennett wasn't going to go down? How about West Virginia? John Racy. There's another good one. The guy who said, you know, I think people ought to make the money the old-fashioned way. They ought to inherit it like I did. And those children ought to go back into the mines like it was in the good old days. And you know what else the Tea Party did for us? Really? I think it woke people like me up. Who had to be reminded that racism is really still alive and well. Granted, we've got an African-American president. We've got a black guy in the White House. Sure. You know, but you look at those Tea Party rallies, and you look at the Jungle Bunny shirts and the Curious George shirts and the all this stuff out there, and you realize that racism is alive and well. And I guess you can thank them for that. And what I find interesting is there's a new study out. It was published in the Journal of Perspectives on Psychological Science. And what they've come up with is they're saying that white Americans feel as though they're more discriminated against than blacks are. Which, again, I'm still trying to figure out. But here's the thing. Sociologists from Harvard and Tufts University asked, you know, several hundred people, white and black, men and women, to rate racism against both economic groups since the 1950s on a scale of 1 to 10. And the results showed that while both blacks and whites saw anti-black racism decreasing, meaning white people being racist against black people, everyone saw that going down over the decades, whites actually said that they were losing out and that blacks were gaining the advantage, that they, the whites, were the discriminated class. You know, you got this group of American whites who have perceived that they've been discriminated against. And for the 2000s, they go into 11% of whites gave anti-white bias the maximum of 10 out of 10. And I'm going, really? Do white people really feel that they're the ones being discriminated against? And I started thinking about myself. I don't ever remember a time where I have ever felt that I had been discriminated against because I was white. In fact, there have been a number of times where I've looked in the mirror and go, thank God I'm white. There have been a number of times where I've been stopped. I've been racially profiled, for instance. I was in a neighborhood that I was unaware of, and the police stopped me and said, what are you doing in the neighborhood, Whitey? And I said, lost. And they helped me out. Again, I'm just not getting it. I'm not getting where this reverse racism seems to be prevalent. Do you, I mean, do you feel that, as do the white people in the audience feel that they're being somehow discriminated against? I know the extreme right loves to throw the affirmative action thing out there, which I've never lost a job through affirmative action, I have to be honest. I can think of one time where I actually got a job over a black guy where I could say, I could see him saying, you know, he was discriminated against because I was just a kid at the time looking for a job in the freight industry. And he was an experienced guy who had been doing the job for a number of years. He didn't get it. I did. So I guess that could be a situation where there was maybe some discrimination. I don't know. But I don't think I've ever felt that. Have you? I mean, I'm missing the boat here. And when I see reports like this that the white people who are doing, I guess, all right, especially when you look at the unemployment rates of African Americans in the 25% range, and you look at the amount of wealth that they hold as a minority group, and you go, really? Can they discriminate against? I'm just not getting it. But that's the report. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with former Congressman Bob Ney from Talk Radio News Service. We're back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
When you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Fillman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME. We
that old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show. I got a news for you. It's going down. Before you come home, tell me. No, not angry. And I'll be leaving. And I'll be leaving.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. Former Congressman Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I got to be honest, last night's big election in New York shows that at least the people of New York are pushing back against Ryan's budget proposal.
You know, it's interesting because when people say, well, who won? Well, nothing against the congressman, you know, elect. But there were other winners and losers, and obviously Congressman Paul Ryan has got to be scratching his head after the vote in the last 2 hours, with the Senate rejecting his budget plan with 5 Republican votes. I think it's back to the drawing board.
Well, I think, you know, we figured out, again, what we've known for years. Social Security, Medicare, you don't touch those.
That's right. When I was in Congress, believe me, if you wanted to rile the troops against you, more than any large corporation even, just go ahead and get the seniors upset. You know, they have a voice in this thing, and I think they felt they weren't part of the process.
Yep, and well, their voices were heard. Some other interesting votes happening this week. The Patriot Act back up for reauthorization.
That's right. It should pass actually on Friday. It's been held up a little bit because Congressman Rand Paul of Kentucky had some gun issues that he held the bill up for. But basically, reauthorization of the Patriot Act, the House said it's moving, of course, in the Senate. So I think that will happen in the Senate on Friday.
As bad as I think it is, I don't think anybody's going to stake their political career on overturning it.
Yeah, you know, I was one of the three original no votes on the Republican side the first round, and at that point in time, we were told, you know, we wouldn't survive that vote. Afterwards, a lot of people fell off and didn't like the bill, but at this point in time, there are some bad provisions of it civil liberties-wise, but I think most things have been worked out that were the real hot spots. It's going to roll.
Yeah, well, for me, I think all of it was there. It was just a matter of streamlining it, and I don't know that I want things too streamlined.
That's right. Well, you know, that was one bill where the left and the right were obviously both complaining about it, which makes you think twice about a piece of legislation if both of them are in that position.
Yeah, well, here we go. White House threatening a veto, I understand, on the defense authorization bill.
Yes, you know, the president made it clear on this whole stealth missile system and the fighter. And the House went ahead and killed it under a conservative move, but yet the authorizers, the people with the language, are putting little pieces here and there. So the president is saying, look, you know, you're not going to carve this thing together like this, and I will veto it. So I imagine the Senate will have a say on that.
Well, I mean, still part of it being this F-35 Joint Strike Fighter engine. Again, I mean, if we're broke, which is what I keep hearing the Republicans telling me, we're broke. Why are we still talking about something that, from what I understand, the military doesn't want?
Military doesn't want it. The some of the fiscal hawks took it out. It was in part of it was in Speaker John Boehner's district, which people wondered how that eventually would go. But the authorizers are putting, basically backdooring and putting pieces back in, and it will cause a larger loss of money doing it this way.
Yeah, I mean, there's part of me that goes, where's the Tea Party people and all this? So this is the kind of stuff that you would naturally think would be something for them to rally against.
Well, yes, and, you know, it was very smart of the White House. Not only do they not want it, but they're pointing out, hey, you know, this is something a lot of people don't want, and we're to the point where we would, you know, veto over this. So I think it was also a good public policy and political move, frankly.
Well, I think the people who have the jobs that this is probably going to cost, I think they would want it, but beside that.
Sure. And that's where, hey, the powers to be, people wonder why their congressman all of a sudden is voting for something like this. Well, it's because the chair of the committee has a lot of power and is putting the muscle down on them.
Yeah. You were in on a press call today with Julian Assange. Tell me how that went.
Well, you know, Talk Radio News Service was on that call, and it's kind of bizarre. I mean, Assange and WikiLeaks is one issue, but he's saying with the Manning case, who is, you know, up for charges of espionage, he's saying that the White House is trying to criminalize journalists, so they're actually calling Manning a journalist. Now, I think they can debate the leak situation and did he have a right to be a whistleblower, but really, on the call today, to say the White House is criminalizing journalists, I can speak for talk radio. We thought that was pretty well stretching it.
That is stretching it, but at the end of the day, I mean, they are really, they're really putting this kid through the ringer.
Wow, he is just being battered in many, many ways, even, you know, prior to a trial. And on this case, I mean, I think Assange's trying to help the issue of Manning, which is fine. The criminalization of the journalist part, I don't know, that one just didn't sit well, but the Manning case itself is a very interesting case, and the guy has just been battered about.
Yeah, if he's done, you know, I mean, if we're going to try him for espionage and we're going to call him treasonous and all this, where's the trial? I mean, it's been quite a long time.
It has, I think. Well, am I correct? In 2 years, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, don't we have something? And I know the military is different than civilian, but you know that whole right to a speedy trial, that whole right to, you know, confront your accuser thing.
Yes, that's right. He has been sitting quite a while, and I think in this case, when they look back on this, I think hopefully they'll learn some lessons about, you know, procedures and when it comes to Manning.
Because some people are calling this kid a hero. Some people are calling him treasonous. How do you see him?
You know, I don't know, of course, the complete insides of any case, but I think there, you know, if you're going to have the whistleblower provisions, then you have them. So I don't personally see it as a treasonous case as much as a whistleblowing case. I guess when the government doesn't like who whistleblows about a certain topic, then they'll throw up the espionage angle.
Yeah, well, it's all who got egg on their face in this. And speaking of speedy trials, in Arizona, the Lautner case come before the court.
Yes, that's, you know, on that one, of course, the judge has said, well, because of the potential problem of mental illness, he's going to take a 4-month, look at this. So in 4 months from now, he'll reassess whether Lautner will be, able to stand trial as mentally competent. And, of course, you know.
I think at this point, this kid, his best defense is to act as crazy as possible. Act up in court, do backflips, whatever.
Right, and that's what he did. He acted up in court, so the judge said, well, we'll take a look at it in 4 months from now. And this, you know, this will set a lot of controversy, obviously, due to the nature of, you know, what's happened in that whole case.
Yeah, at the end of all this, the only thing that I want to see is he never sees the light of day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just... Oh, it was the whole thing. Any life taken is disgusting. This whole of what he did and who he did it to and you know how he did it was just it highlights terrible actions by monsters.
I mean, as a former congressman, I mean you have to be able to tell some pretty wicked stories of people doing not shooting you, but you know making some obvious overt threats.
Well, we had problems in over the course of the years, and everybody always, in the back of their mind, worried of what happened to Gabby could have happened, you know, to them. And, you know, the only sin of these people is they're out with public service, and somebody comes along and does this, it puts a chilling effect on, you know, members then going out amongst the public like they should.
Yeah, because, you know, look at the way things are. It's 50-50. You're making people happy half the time and miserable the other half. I'll tell you, I wouldn't want the job.
I know. Somebody said about would I want to go back? I said, well, not these days.
Yeah, it's just plain nuts. Bob Ney, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Bob Ney, Talk Radio News Service. You know, here in the state of Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania House Democrats, they failed to force any consideration of the natural gas drilling tax. Again, you know, this is one of those moments where you go, some sanity has to play into this. Democratic Representative Greg Vitale, he was one of the people who sponsored the bill, wanted to get some, you know, just to get a vote on it, because I think we need to know who's on board with this, who's going to hold this up. All the Republicans and four Democrats voted to prevent Vitale's bill from discharging the proposal on the Finance Committee and onto the House floor. Again, you know, if you're going to ask me to cut $1 billion from education, you're going to ask me to cut 56% of higher education, you're going to ask me to do all these things, take money away from those folks who are sitting in wheelchairs today. If you're going to ask me to do that, shouldn't we reach out and make others help out a little bit? I mean, just a little bit. I think that's the rational thing to do. Also in the news here, federal prosecutors, they're set to challenge what they're calling unduly lenient sentencing of former Pennsylvania Senator Vince Fumo. Fumo was sentenced to 55 months in jail. And then what the federal prosecutors are saying, it's a bit too lenient. So they're going to file a motion and see if they can do something. Federal guidelines had the possible sentencing at more than 20 years. So out of it, he got 55 months. Lucky man, or, you know, well-connected, however you want to look at that. Hazleton Mayor, former Hazleton Mayor, now U.S. Congressman Lou Barlotta, evidently no one is allowed to bring in any recording equipment, no video, no audio, none of that stuff. According to Barletta's spokesman, Sean Kelly, he says the policy was instituted so constituents can speak their mind without fear of seeing their remarks showing up on the Internet. Oh, yeah, I'm buying that one. Again, you know, what the Republicans learned from what happened in Lebanon and what really happened when they went home a couple of weeks ago and got beat up by Granny going, what? You're going to steal Medicare? What they learned, you shut it off. You don't let anybody come in. You don't let anybody record anything. And you do it in a way, well, hey, you know, we're protecting our constituents. We're worried about them. And, I mean, really, does anybody buy that? Does anybody buy it? I mean, I know I don't buy it from Barlotta. Again, but he's another guy. Thank you for voting for the Ryan budget. That is going to come up. All of those seniors up in the Hazleton area and up in that district who voted for him because he was against them immigrants, they're going to look at themselves and go, what, you were going to take my Medicare? Bye-bye. Let's see how unemployment does for you. Maybe one of those anti-immigration think tanks will pick him up. And that's what's great about being a Republican. And I often say that I should be. Because, you know, if you fail, think tank job. Look at Santorum. He got thumped by Casey. Roundly and soundly thrown out of office. High paying, cushy think tank job. What more could you want? And that's what I'm saying. A lot of these people who are running for president, throwing their names into the rings, you know, they want those wealthy paying think tank jobs. They want that billionaire money flowing in. They want the Koch brothers money. They want the Scaife money. They want it. Because, you know, as that Daryl Issa told me once when I met him in the halls of Congress, when we were talking about Tom Daschle getting the job, potentially getting the job of Health and Human Services Secretary. He goes, well, you know, everybody needs a job. And that's their mentality. Everybody needs a job. Even if it is with a well-paying think tank who's going to screw workers out of their rights. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap this thing up. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It would be fun to have a tea party, wouldn't it? I look at my daughter. She loves to have a tea party with her little sister, and they have their little cups and their doilies and their little cookies. Oh, how cute. How cute. just nuts. But, you know, again, you know, I go back to what the Tea Party brought us, and it brought us austerity. It's bringing us this this angry mentality. You know, we talked about it a little bit before about what things the Tea Party brought us. It brought us this angry mentality. And, you know, look, they're organizing. And this is where I say sane, rational people have to begin that kind of energy, that organizing to save the school system, to save the social safety net in this country. And I read an article in the New York Times that, again, it's just the way things are going to be in the future from now on. I guess going forward, public education is no longer going to be free. You're evidently going to be paying, you know, just like going to college, registration fees and technology fees and instructional fees, you name it, they're going to figure out a way to nickel and dime you to death. In fact, the article talks about one family in Medina, Ohio, who evidently the Medina City schools are having real difficult financial problems. Because, again, the states have walked away from funding education, left it up to the local tax base. And, of course, you know, they're having some problems with the local tax base as well. Like, I think every community across our state at some point is going to have. But they're talking about this family, this Dombrus family, who have, you know, their children, you know, in basic courses, you know, like Spanish and earth science. You know, they've done some things like band, they run cross country and track, and they, you know, they do some of these things. For the family, for their year of public education, it costs them almost $4,500. Just for these extracurricular activities and these academic classes. And what you're seeing across the country is you're seeing this move towards putting fees on everything. And I remember going back when I was in school. The great thing about school was that there was so much to try, so much to experience, things that, you know, hey, I might like this, I might not, but let me try it. If now you're putting a fee on that, how many people are going to reach in their pocket and say, you know, I want to explore something different? And I guess this is part of the whole push to really destroy public education and really destroy critical thinking and destroy the minds of the future. That's the only thing I can come up with. But you go through some of this stuff, and the fee structure in some of these schools, if you want to do anything, is outrageous. You know, $100 for this, $100 for that. If you want to be a cheerleader in the one school in Massachusetts, it's $408. If you want to play ice hockey, it's over $700. If you want to do, if you want to wrestle, which wrestling, I'm going, wrestling? $500? Isn't that just wearing funny little tights and you know, messing around with some other guy on a mat? What's the cost in that? But here again, you know, it's this whole, the school in Minnesota costs $190 to join the debate team. Are they charging by the word? I mean, at some point you go, really? The same school, $150 to join the chess club. Really? Is this what we want for our children? Is this what the future is going to hold? This is, as I have told you a number of times, this is conservative world where everything has a price. Everything is a cost. Now, when I was in school, the only thing that you paid for above and beyond that you paid for was driver's ed. If you wanted to take driver's ed, I think it was like $60. But that was a private for-profit interest. That wasn't even part of the school. They just offered the service. Everything else, you wanted to play baseball, you wanted to play football, and I did. I played baseball, football, hockey, basketball. I played it all. I experienced as much as I could. I took Spanish. I took all the different courses I could take. Now, if my children want to do that, we're going to be reaching into our pockets every time they turn around, which is going to mean that they're going to have a less fulfilling high school and academic career as they go on. You know, I say nickel and dime them when they get to college. I mean, beat them to death when they get to college. We're turning high school now into what college used to be. And are you happy with that? Because I got to be honest with you. You know, I sit here and as I look back over my life, I've done some very, very good things, done some things I'm not happy with, but I've done all right. I've led a very solid middle class existence. My kids are never going to see the suffering, the pain, the misery, the poverty that I saw as a child. And it was because I got an education. It's because I stayed in school. There was a time, and you know, it was right after my mother passed away, that I could have quite easily dropped out of school, and had it not been for extracurricular activities, had it not been for sports, had it not been for my football coach, who, you know, passed away a number of years ago, but he was a guy who whipped me into shape. and gave me something to get up and go to school for. And I know there are others out there who've got the exact same story. And you went to school because, you know what, I want to play football, or I want to play basketball, or I want to play baseball, or I want to be part of this play or this debate team or whatever. Or, you know, field hockey or volleyball, whatever. But if you had to reach into your pocket, because I didn't have the money to do this, if you had to reach into your pocket, would you have done it? And would you have stayed? This is what is really scaring me about this direction. I look back on myself, and I use myself as the litmus for a lot of things. You know, would I have stayed in school, or would I have dropped out by 10th grade had it not been for football? Because that's what really got me back into it. I was completely incorrigible. You know, I had played basketball early on. I had done a lot of things eighth, ninth grade when I was in the high school there. But it wasn't until I started playing football that I cared. I was lost. I was off on an island somewhere, and no one could reach me. It was this thing that brought me back. And yet you look at some of these numbers to play football, you're looking at several hundred dollars. And I'm going, you know, who's got that kind of money, especially today? How many poor families are going to be able to reach into their pockets and pay that kind of the cash, especially in the poorer school districts who are already struggling to make ends meet? And yet you've got a government, a state government, who's saying we're going to cut that even further? It makes absolutely no sense. And they're trying to sell it as, well, you know, we shouldn't make the taxpayers, you know, pay for all of the luxuries of education. Excuse me. I'm happy to pay for it. I benefited from it. And every person who's listening to this program benefited from it. And now we want to turn around and slam the door on that generation coming up behind us just because, oh, gee, it's going to cost me an extra nickel. Or, oh, gee, I need an extra, little extra cheese on my sandwich. Have we become that petulant? Have we become that self-centered, narcissistic? Have we become that greedy? That not only are we going to ruin the lives of our own children, but someone else's. And you know who that someone else's children could be? That could be the doctor that saves your life. That could be the paramedic that saves your life. But I guess we don't think that far down the road. It's all about the here and now, the me and now. Hooray for me and screw everybody else. Anyway, one last thing I want to get to. Our friends over at Carlisle Cares, they're having a hot dog sale over at the Nell's on Walnut Bottom Road in Carlisle on June 3rd and 4th, on the 17th, 18th, also in July, the 1st and 2nd, the 15th and 16th. They're having a bunch of these out there on the Friday, all day Friday, and Saturdays from 9:30 to 2:30. They're looking for help. Again, the people at Carlisle Cares do such good work with the homeless. Give them an opportunity to get off the streets and have a place to get out of the cold or the heat and take a shower, look for jobs. They do fantastic work, which is why we support them here at the Rick Smith Show. And anything we can do to help them, I think we'll put something on our site to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to go over and support them. It's a great cause. They're great people. I hope that the people of the community will come out and help them. And we'll be announcing it every once in a while between now and then. And we'll see what we can do to help as well. Again, I want to thank all the people who came on the program. State Representative Eugene DePasquale, our good friend Irwin Aronson. Of course, Reed Mackey from the National Consumers Union, and of course, Linda Stout, her book Collective Visioning. Of course, you. Thanks for being here. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the bitter sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array.
Democracy. Replay. The There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he had been saving for just the right occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so goddamn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally screwed Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news.
That rises, and I'm sorry, we're running out of time, that rises to the level of prophecy. Go listen to it on YouTube. He was talking about in 1971 things that are reality in 2011.